expected for us. Whether you want to take tea first if tea is ready, or we can start the meeting. And all our members will just move really to have anything that are invited, colleagues and members of the Foreign and National Council. Thank you very much for your understanding. Thank you very much for understanding. We do appreciate your presence. It would enrich our own discussion on any issues that are facing us. We are colleagues facing good morning, colleagues, and good morning to our members. It's better that we start our meeting. The day is long for us today, and we should be. Well, on our agenda, really, there are two areas that we wanted to have a discussion on. First will be our interaction with the National Coalition Council on the traditional and coalition leadership field. These have been preliminary discussions, really, general preliminary discussion. And we have our guest from Ghana. He's going also to assist us to understand how a Ghanaian and a Pidomide issue of traditional leadership. I think we'll always be free to make intervention even if after we have made some presentation. This meeting is not a decision making meeting, though. The meeting date will be at the views and on the general and a broad aspect of things around the traditional leadership for this meeting. But because we are meeting with Koi and the National Council, and what is their view on many other issues, really, not just on the deal, whatever issue they want us to take note of, I think they'll be free to do so. We think a very important meeting for us is our first meeting to interact with them. But then I think we should do that. And then after that, then we'll have a presentation, I think, by our colleagues from Ghana. Some presentation that we would appreciate that. Benson, you're fine. Can in all ways well prepared, as I told you. We'll make some presentation on the experience of traditional leadership in Ghana. But what are the view and observation on some of the areas that we are dealing with here? And I hope you are also giving our bill to look at it and may have some comment on the bill, as I said. We really welcome that. Because it's very important to deal with this matter, given the fact that they have been there for some time. Yeah, I think they are able to, I'm not sure if I'm correct, democratize the institution of traditional leadership, modernize it, become the institution really that goes to power. And it's very important to do that, to allow the space to take us through. Any apology from our honorable members, would be a better idea, though, members, to come closer. And members of the committee, I think there's sufficient space for you to be not far away from us. So the visiting committee, any can, sitting next to us, next to the army, Honorable Masondo. I think Honorable Masondo, all these members are not facing ethics inquiries. And because I'm not sure I'm scared to sit next to you. And, they're not appearing before your committee to account for their conduct. And then I think they must be free to sit next to you. There is also a couple of presentations by Mr. Wilberforce. I think all these do have a copy. And there's a very important copy because we assist us a lot of some of the issues that we have. Honorable member, you're welcome to come in. And, okay. Let us start, colleagues, and have this interaction with the National Coalition Council. National Chairperson is here, and then the delegation is here. If National Chairperson would like to introduce them, we are really at your hand. Sometimes I'm told that traditionally that should are not introduced, sometimes I'm told they can be introduced. There's a very difficult thing. Some I'm told as common as hand introduced. I'm not sure I'm not common either, but generally those some of the things that have been done. Can we invite you, Ms. Chair?
The chairperson, can I kindly request that our friend from Ghana go first with his presentation? That's the way we planned. If he's with your condolences.
Yeah, colleagues, I think we can take that, and I don't think it's very problematic. Let's start with Mr. Wilberforce. Mr. Wilberforce. And I think, Yancy, you may want to so choose it. Then that would be proper for us to choose it. And thanks.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. It is a great honor for me, myself, Ms. Yancy, to introduce our colleague from Ghana. He is from an organization for indigenous knowledge and organizational development, and they've been working a lot around methodologies for indigenous development. And particularly since Ghana has been in a post-colonial era since the 1950s, they've also been doing and thinking a lot around the issue of traditional leadership. And because our organization, Natural Justice, has been a partner with the acronym CICOT, or organization, for a number of years, and the issue of the bill has come up, we just thought it would be very useful for the committee to learn about the approach of indigenous development and its place in post-colonial and post-apartheid South Africa. And then we also thought that it would be useful for them to share around their thinking around the traditional leadership system, and just from that shared experience, what actually offers, particularly given the kind of critiques that's been heralded against the bill, I just think that that was a useful learning for the Parliament. So with that said, we've invited Mr. Wilberforce Latte, who's a very experienced indigenous development practitioner, and we look very forward to listening to his experience today for the committee. And on that note, I also would really like to thank our chairperson and the committee for the time and being willing to really give this year to our colleague from Ghana. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the introduction. I already said honorable Wilberforce. And yes, that and Mr. Wilberforce take a platform and make a presentation.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, and good morning, Honorable Members. And thank you very much for the opportunity to address this House. My presentation will take this form. First of all, I want to look at, like Leslie said, I want to look at this concept of indigenous development, and then we also want to now place, because that's the context under which the traditional authority, traditional institutions fall. So as an organization, we believe so much that in order to move forward, we must look backwards. We must look backwards to ideals of the past, the good things that we have left behind, the good things that, in a way, were taken away from us. So we are not just saying that, look back, but if you look on your sheet or on the screen, you find this proverbial bed in Ghana, called in Sankofa. Go back for it. But we are not saying that go back for everything, but we are saying that go back for the ideals of the past, and move forward with it. Pick out the ideals, let the ideals be the building blocks, and then build the foundation, and then you can use external resources to build on that. Then you also realize that we have three sectors. Most of our interventions have been around material needs. But then as Africans, especially, we are also spiritual beings. We also have social systems that are very strong. In fact, the world has the capital, financial capital itself, but we have the social capital. And we think that we need to also be mindful about that. Now, when you look at endogenous development, what exactly is endocrine development? We believe so much that it is development that is within. I learned from my spiritual father, like Benel, that is from within, you know, and as people, we need to look more at what is coming from us. And the role of the Senna Intervener is just to strengthen this process for us. We are saying that a combination of modernity is a combination of our indigenous knowledge. So our indigenous knowledge that represents our institutions, our resources, our worldview, the way we see the world, as Africans, is very important. But we are not saying that we want to be indigenous people, just indigenous people. We are saying that we should have appropriate external knowledge, you know, to add on to the community. And we so much believe that the communities already have capacity. But what we need to do is to use external knowledge to build on these capacities. So, we place very much importance on worldviews for our culture. Then also the indigenous knowledge and also the appropriate external knowledge. And we believe that this government that starts from within, we as a community are already on our path. Externalities or external people come in and they go out. And we believe that as they come in and go out, they also learn, because they learn from us if they want to really do that. But then we are on our journey, we know where we are going. We might not be very sure exactly the destination, but we believe that we are on a path. We have been there many years before the colonial masters came. And they came to meet a system. They came to meet a structure. If they had not met anything, they would have been dead long before they even came. They would have met a background. But they came to meet a system. And our system has gone through a lot of trials and challenges, but still the resilience has been there. So our community, we're on our path. And anybody who comes to work with us, come in and go out. So, once they interrupt the processes, some of them will come out, I mean, the external agents, and that happens to us as field workers. You go to the community, you learn so much from them, that by the time you get out of the community, you are changed, or you begin to modify the approach you use. This idea came about because we realized that communities have capacities to ignore. We fail to identify these capacities and work with them. And at the end of the day, we end up doing nothing. There was a case in Ghana where we went to a community. We wanted to, our contact with the youth, and wanted to bring in, as they say, patients to call to the elders. They said, no, you don't worry, we'll go later on. And they really misled us. At the end of the day, we developed, it was a 28,000 dosage build project. We fixed everything and we couldn't launch it because the elders were not part of it. And it was very difficult to get the elders on board because the youth actually led us in doing so. And so I just wanted to quickly look at the diagram that has the constellations of our cosmovision or related colleges. You have the spiritual only, you have the natural only, you also have the social only. But then you realize that in the center of it, you find the natural, the spiritual, and the social. And that is where we want to focus on. Because as Africans, we believe in these three circles, these three constellations, these three worldviews, and whatever we are doing. For instance, in this stage where we are talking about genetically modified stuff, just imagine that you take genes from a pig and you want to put it into maize. Have you considered the implication for the Muslim family, the Muslim community, who don't take pork? And there was a case in Ghana where they put up a facility for a Muslim community. And you know, the Muslim goes to the washroom and needs water. But that facility didn't meet the use of water. So, for 3 years, the facility was standing there. Nobody used it. You know, until we had to go back and find out. And then we realized that the design was wrong. And so, we need to really engage community people and understand where they come from, especially their spiritual and social needs. Most of the time, we look more at the material needs, but we need to look beyond that one and also look at the spiritual needs. And that we believe that is going to lead us to understand where we are coming from. And our interventions will also be the more sustainable. There's a big challenge when we start talking about the indigenous development, and they say that, well, it's also Pacific development. But the issue is, whose agenda are we pursuing? Are we pursuing the community's agenda, or are we pursuing our own agenda? Whatever we want to change, whatever information we are bringing from the external, must fit into theirs. They should try the process. They should lead the process. When they lead the process, we realize that it comes along with a lot of strength. And so, I want to say, we emphasize that indigenous development is a development that starts from within, from the people, from the forest. You know, we want to go here. Most of the time, they don't know exactly how they want to do it. But they know definitely that they want to do something. And we should encourage them to build on the available local resources. And so we have developed a number of tools that help us do that. First of all, identify the institutions and also identify the resources that are in the community. There are so many examples in Ghana where people claim that they don't have resources. But there's a woman who realized that, no, in our community there are lots of stones. So she organized the women, and that's a traditional woman leader. She organized the women, they collected the stones, and sold it to a conductor. The money they got, they used it to farm gallows. You know, and they were so amazed at what they were able to do themselves. And that group said, well, okay, we have come up with an action plan. Can you please provide us with money to do it? Another woman said, definitely if you want to go to the assistance of Amy, you want to rather provide more resources to those who started something from themselves, you know, from their own. They were able to initiate their own change processes. And I believe that rural communities need that kind of support. We should encourage them to initiate their own processes. Once they initiate it, they will maintain it. But if you can't do it for them, it becomes your project. There's a retention of energies at the local level, and you realize that they are able to really engage. What they need is strengthening of their capacity. Most of the time, people use the term capacity building. But we believe that people already have capacities. All we need to do is to strengthen them. But there are some forces that are undermining indigenous development. One is the new liberal economic development policy. You know, so for instance, you have this issue of foreign markets, foreign investments and things. Those are some of the things. The technology and scientific change that we impose on communities. Western religion. Because once you talk about the spiritual, then it will say paganism and stuff. But spirituality has nothing to do with that. You are respecting the world. I am a Christian. I go to the community and I tolerate their practices. If I want to work with them, then I need to respect their practices. I need to identify with them, and then we'll be able to do that. There's also this, our youth, how we bring them up. There's a complete disregard for our cultural practices. And we think that there's another big challenge. And also our quest for quick results. Because everything is modernized, sanitized, so we want quick things, and that's where we get ourselves into. There's also been the suppression of indigenous sciences. We say that we have sciences. We only have one science. The Western science is one, but our African, we have sciences. If you look at the way our people lived, they went through a lot of things before they went to arrive at the lifestyle that they opted for. They did a lot of experimentation. It has been so much that if we encourage them, they will also be able to do the same thing. And so, we're saying that as Africans, our spirituality and our social needs are as important as our material needs. So whatever we are thinking of, we should be mindful of that. And that brings us to the issue of the traditional authority system, where we are coming from. Because we believe that we need to strengthen that. They have been there. They have been part of the governance system in Ghana. In Ghana, we have dualism. The politicians, sorry, honorable ministers, but the politicians definitely don't want to openly acknowledge that. But we are in election year in Ghana now. Every politician will go to the village to meet the chiefs. Every politician will go to the paramount. They are showing that regard for them. You know, they are saying that we know you are the gatekeepers to this traditional area. But after that, after they won their elections, you don't find them again. But they respect them. They respect them. And the fact that they respect them gives us that hope and that encouragement. Now we need to really look at the institution, because it's designed in the 1992 constitution, you know, but then the challenge is that the politicians are not giving resources to the chief to work. And I've been there, even though they don't have that support. The constitution has provided no clear guidelines on the development and governance role of the traditional leaders. Their role has been relegated to matters of traditional rule, customary law and practice. You know, so in a short while, I would just make us look at what is the traditional authority system in Ghana. And for us, we define traditional authority as the structure, the systems, the processes which communities have involved in the course of their history and development to govern themselves. So these are processes, it's a painful over time. And when we say traditional authority in Ghana, it's not just one person. It's not about the chief. It's a system. And so in the Northern Ghana, you have the chief, you have the women leaders, and then you have the youth leaders, you have the traditional priests. And in most parts of Northern Ghana, when you are talking about land, it's not the chief who talks about land. It's the traditional people they call in Ghana. In other areas, they call it in Ghana, soap and stuff. They are responsible for land. The chief doesn't talk about land. In the south, you have the chiefs, you have the male leaders, you have the youth women leaders, and all of that. But we realize that the important thing for us is the role that they perform. There are constitutional rules, there are traditional rules, they initiate projects, they manage community resources, they mobilize their people and stuff. But the constitution, you have the National House of Chiefs, you have the Regional House of Chiefs, and so you have the traditional councils that are headed by the paramount chiefs. And then you also have the divisional areas. So the divisional areas come together to form the paramountcy. Now members of the every paramount chief is represented in the Regional House of Chiefs. So the regional you call provincia. You are below that, you are the paramount chiefs that are operating at the district level. And then from the regional, they go to the National House of Chiefs. And the presence of the National House of Chiefs, together with another person, joins the Council of State. So you see how the structure goes. And you realize that most of them are represented on committees that are set up by the president, you know. They also perform roles at the lower level. And so they are not enforced bylaws. So within the traditional and that at the paramount level, they come out with things that they think should be related. And these they put together and present legislative assembly, and it is gazetted and becomes a bylaw. And so they are not enforced these bylaws. They also settle disputes and conflicts. And I must also say that at the traditional council level, the paramount chief oversees the activities in the divisional or stural areas. And this is where you have land. So, first of all, they are within the geographical space, that is the traditional area. Sometimes it covers more than a district, but sometimes it's only just one district. And then, and sometimes it also crosses over three or four districts. You know, but then you come down to the divisional area where you have land. And it is actually managed by the divisional chief and then the lower chief. But this all comes under the supervision of the paramount chief. And so we believe that structure is very important for us as a people. So apart from these roles that we perform, we also have leadership institutions. So you have the chief, the queen, and then you have the social support institutions within the system. And that's when you find the family, the household. If you touch one person, you touch a clan, you touch a family, you know, in Ghana. And there are so many social networks, and those are very important in the evolution and development of our culture. Then you also have the social control institutions. People say they got a whole thing that the chief are all powerful. They are not. For instance, the festival. I am a Ghana, I come from Accra. and we are the Homo Festival. The experience is the 1 week, the week-long festival. And I can say anything about anybody, including the chief, and I will not be someone anywhere. So it's a thing of adaptability. And normally they will just say, if they say it, it will just vanish. But it will compose a song. So just imagine as a chief and your grandchild comes singing a song about you. So she doesn't know about how corrupt you are, about how unaccountable you are. And that is a social and other platform that regulates the behavior of the chief. You also have the male leaders, you also have the queen mothers. In the tribe, it's the queen mother who actually lays or nominates the chief. And the queen mother is either a brother, a sister to the chief, or the mother of the chief. And after naming them, I must say that after naming them, in most cases, they don't respect them again. I mean, respect in terms of providing enough resources. But a lot of them are reforming now, because that's what we are engaging them on. And the festival alone, they have different shapes of festival. They can't suspend, they have considered all, it's a kind of a 40-year, a 40-day period. So just imagine, the ship goes out, and it's not on phone. It has to account to its people. If you look at the account system especially, that certainly dresses gorgeously. But it's a chief who is responsible for his regalia. So he kind of wears these things, comes back, and he has to report back. He has to kind of return the things he wore out. So they are not for him. It's for the system. But they are putting these things to check the way people do things. One institution in Ghana, the Economic Development Institution, is what we call a SUSU group. I don't know the equivalent, but I know you have it in South Africa. It's a small savings, you know. So you get somebody goes around and collects money from market women and stuff. The banks in Ghana realized that they were not getting money from the market women. And so now they are now employed staff who also go to do the SUSU play. And that's more related to that show, that they have to run away with the money. Not like somebody can just go away with the savings that he has collected for the day. But the banks have adopted the system, and they are using it very well. And so, we have the tradition, the tribal chief, we have the lower chief, you know, and we think that these are the important areas where we need to work on. So you have the chief, you have the queen mother, you have the handhead, you have the elders, you have the youth leader, you have the traditional priest. These together form the unit or the traditional authority system. And that's how it has been working in Ghana. And they end up and enforce by laws, resolve conflicts, lobby and initiate projects. And we believe that if we continue with our work, because we have been accused several times of working or promoting undemocratic structures. The system is very democratic. In Ghana, I don't know whether you have had an experience, honorable members, but the chief is the one who speaks last. So you have the elders, if there's an issue, they all bring their views. He sums them up. And that's why when he speaks, you know, so you have to listen to, just like the judge. When a judge gives his verdict, that is it. But a judge doesn't speak. There's a jury who supports it. And we have our system. Our elders are jury. You know, so I really want to say that we in South Africa, we need to identify what we have in this system. When we do away with the chief at that level, we are doing away with all these structures. Because he's the head of this system. And that system is what portrays our culture. Our values. Because of time, I want to rush it. Yeah, so there was a study that was conducted by GIZ, and over 96% believe of the respondents, out of 96% of 391 respondents, think chiefs are still relevant today in Ghana. 79% think they are effective in performing their roles. You know, And a lot of them were trying to compare with the religious assemblies. But on the whole, they decided that chiefs or the traditional authority system has more effective. And yes, but the system is not just perfect. There are quite some challenges with it. Because we have, like I said, we have been accused of promoting undemocratic governance structures. Our chiefs are generally perceived as unaccountable, corrupt, undemocratic, and they are selfish. It's because of that we started to engage them. Because we tell them, and they fight with us. And our strategy has been to identify and strengthen the capacities of progressive chiefs, you know, so that they can use those sort of stories. For them to also engage their peers on that one. And then we realize that a traditional woman leader is very important, but its role has been relegated down. So we spend quite some time trying to strengthen their capacities so that they can match the men. You know, some of the men who are bad, they can really engage them. There's also another position for us also to have kind of a royal college. They mentioned that we've not been able to institute it because we have different cultures and different systems. And who are you going to get? What kind of curriculum are you going to run for them? So we are still working on that one. But one practical thing we have done is to develop what we call the charter. In one region, we took the community, the traditional council, the regional house of chiefs. So I said, we have the national house of chiefs, we have the regional. So we went to the regional house of chiefs, and we said, we want to support them. And we told them our problem is that we are accused, that they are undemocratic. And they got mad. They said, no. It's not about you getting mad. It's about you proving that you are not who they are saying. Because perceptions come true or not. And so the Brahmin Hakka regime decided to document their systems and practices. So they have developed a charter on beneficiary, a charter on the allocation of resources. And our intention is to now cover the entire country. But beyond the region, what we have also started is that we are going down to the paramounts that make up. There are 49 paramounts. It was only the 49 male chiefs who developed this bylaw. Their subjects are not aware. The digital chiefs are not aware. So, for the past year, what we have been doing is to go down and tell them that your big men have developed these documents. Can you hold them accountable for it? You know, and that's one way we think that they can improve their image for us as a country. And they took it very well. And apart from two traditional councils, they gave us excuse. And we suspected when we come to a great problem for this. You know, like I said, not all of them are correct. But they believe that when you come and tell our people, my people, that, or the Queen Mother, traditionally everything that is given to the male chief, one third belongs to the Queen Mother. And some of them don't know. So the male chief pockets everything. But then it's documented. So if you come and tell my people that this is your right, this is the way we want to do things, then you have a problem when you lose. And also when it has to do with social responsibility agreements, you know, like a mining concession or a timber firm wants to do something in the community, they need to have that kind of agreement before central government will give the terms. And most of the time, it's just the chief and they settle the chief and that's it. And with this document, you are saying that no one single chief should be able to, you know, do that kind of discussion with the people. It should be a committee that is put together under the paramount that should engage the people. And all these things are documented and they are adhering to them. So, I don't think we are generous enough to give you some time, but I want to end maybe there might be some questions. And we live so much that if you look at the institution, you might want to go away with it. But if you look at ways that you can bring appropriate external resources, you'll be able to restore the dignity of the chief service institution. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Wilberforce. I think we do have the call for the presentation. Let me invite honorable members who pose a question and to engage with their presentation. If there are areas that you want more elaboration, Please be seated, also. Honorable Malham.
So, I'm always the first one to ask a question. Mr. Plate, a very interesting presentation. A couple of questions. It seems like you're struggling with many of the same issues that we're struggling with. In other words, the issues of the role of traditional leaders or traditional authorities in society. Now, as far as we are concerned today, that's almost a side issue that we will be dealing with in section, I think it's 23 and 24 of the draft bill that we're looking at. But the issue that I want to question you about is, how does this relate to the issues of the Khoi and the San in South Africa, who have a very different structure, if you will, of leadership? So that's the first part. The second is, you talk about the issues of, for example, good governance and the fact that traditional leaders are perceived as undemocratic, selfish, corrupt, etc., that the youth are not interested in this, that modern society is moving past traditional authorities, if you will. Could you perhaps explain what in your view the role of traditional authorities should be, as opposed to what it is now? And secondly, what is their role in terms of decision making and in terms of judicial processes?
I also want to ask the structure, particularly the executive and the politician, when they come together. How do the traditional one initiate projects and also mobilize the community for those projects? How is it synchronized? Looking to our structure where we have a national province and the later part of the government at the local level. How do you think this can be balanced in your presentation? Because I see here you also talk about that they mobilize, the tradition, their role to mobilize, galvanize, initiate projects. How is this being done as compared to our municipality or also to our local?
Thank you very much, honorable members. Let me do with the last one first. So in terms of projects, there's one committee that government, several communities, but one example I can give you, they went to strike the borehole for a community. The government, central government. And normally they would do that through the district assembly or municipal assembly. And the community refused to use the water because the site was wrong. It was close to their former old burial grounds. So there was no way they were going to drink the water. And so we have, one of the tools we have developed is to engage the district assembly. And currently we are running, we are doing that work with them, where we engage the district assembly together, so we enter into the district and not just one community, and encourage the district to do this properly. The traditional authorities are there. They are the gatekeepers. You know, so in some cases, you realize that the district assemblies collaborate with the traditional authorities, and they are able to tell you that this community or ours lacks this or that or that. They are on top of their communities. And when they initiate the project with them, they are able to get the communal labor and all those things from the community. You know, and that for us is very important. Like I said, who's initiating, whose agenda are we pursuing? It's very important. But I must say that this is early days here, because in many cases, a lot of things are happening, which are very good. And in some cases, the traditional authorities at that level, and the district chief executives from the former system are no longer here. you would want this in terms of the representative of the president. And so if you don't go his way, and especially in Ghana, our chiefs are supposed to be non-partisan. They are not supposed to be involved in active partisan politics. And so if you, a chief, make the politicians know that you openly declare your status, that you belong to this party, definitely when they come to power, they won't mind you. I don't have anything. But they are not supposed, of course they will go and vote, but they are not supposed to use their position openly like that, you know, to win support for any political party. And in areas where they have done that, they have had those backlashes, where they deny that community. The chief executive comes into office and he knows that this is an opposition community. Because of the chief, because of the way the chief openly comes out. So there's been some good collaboration actually. And they also have a community development wing of the assembly who are supposed to be going out to work more with the community. I don't know what else. Thank you very much, sir. The role of traditional authorities is well spelled out. I think maybe what I you didn't get the point I'm making. I'm talking more of endogenous development. The fact that the youth, the African youth, are not so much interested in our culture, but not the traditional authorities. The traditional authorities are well established, and everybody in Ghana belongs to one or the other. You know, so of course I wouldn't have anything to do with it. So because I think I live in the city, you know, so fine. But then the bylaws, I have to respect them, even though I may not be interested in them. During the Omowo festival that I was talking about in the Ghana state, there's a ban on drumming and dancing for one, drumming and noise making for 1 month. Now you have some of the churches and other entertainment centers who violated the law. The youth, we call them a sample, you know, like the military for the traditional council. They went and demolished I mean, I attacked them. And then there was a serious issue. So, for 3 years, it was okay. But fortunately, it has come now. Because now the religious leaders, the bar operators and everything, they now have to meet with them and say, look, we're not saying that you shouldn't change, you shouldn't clap. But we are saying that minimize the noise making. Because our ancestors are visiting us during this period. It's a period for our God to visit us, and they can't, and whether we believe it or not, this is their territory. And so you have to respect it. You know. So that's what I can say about the issue. Now talking about a question, I think when my colleague because I found myself working with traditional authorities, when it presents, there's a similar structure. A similar structure to the traditional council one, where you have a body, you know, that collaborates with, or that serves as a guiding whatever to the lower communities, you know. So you have those structures, and I believe that in South Africa, definitely we have that. If not even from the Queensland, I believe that those structures were there. I mean, you were not fortunate like us. You only had one. Masters came and left. They were also different. I mean, the days came and all that, you know, but apart from the British. But what I can say for sure is that some of our institutions survived. Some didn't survive. In the Upper West, for instance, the women leader position went off. So through our work, one community member said that, I remember that woman said, that woman was about 70 years when she was talking to us. She said, when she was 8 years, she remembers that they had a community, a woman leader. When she's going out, she doesn't go out alone. She goes out in the company of other women, about 3 or 4 women. And whatever, I mean, she was bleeding then. But she couldn't remember much more than what she could tell us. Because then she was 8 years old. So she couldn't remember. But then, we realized that decision was cut off. So now we have to appeal to the male chief, that look, we have evidence that shows that this institution existed some time ago. And I can say today that in most of the traditional areas in the Upper West region, they have the female, they call them popna, female traditional leaders. You know, so the situation has gone through some challenges and it's reforming, it's evolving over time. You know, I don't know whether I've got you right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Professor. My first question is related to the issues you have put up in the reservation about interpretation of the customary law. That what authority are the kings, are the traditional leaders having in relation to the actual implementation of that? I mean, like the case of South Africa, the constitution becomes the supreme law, and if there are issues for this that relate to customary law, now a decision taken by traditional leaders does not supersede the decision that court would take. Then how do you reconcile this? As a country, the role of the constitution and also the role of traditional leaders in implementing customary law. The role of in the case you have mentioned the fact that since time immemorial that your traditional leaders have been involved in government. Traditional leaders in the context also are not elected on traditional leaders. Now we have elected public representatives in the form of we here, who are given a mandate to represent the people in a democratic fashion. Now, how do you reconcile the fact that we have chiefs sitting here with us, and then there's a democratic process that we take a decision in a democratic way, and which will undermine the role of a team or traditional leader that we have? Can coexist a democratic power with the traditional leadership power? How do you reconcile to have the two coexisting? The issue of, I think I like the issue that you raised about traditional leaders eliminating customs or practices that are not assisting to the development of the people. Do you have a country that you can say, look, we have an issue in South Africa about circumcision, for instance, where people die and so on and so on. But we do not have a common platform where we can have an engagement in relation to that and say, what is better? Instead, we have traditional leaders refusing at all to listen into possibility of considering other. How would we have a country of traditional leaders looking to eliminating those lacking? I've always believed, like in studying the evolution of man, that the evolution of the traditional leadership evolved from the establishment of a families, and then communities, and then nations. And how do you, is your traditional leadership based on ownership of land? How do you relate that with who owns land? Is it the state, which is the government, or the traditional leadership in the divine territories? Thank you.
You say that in Ghana, the land issue, the land question, issues of development located in the indigenous section. In South Africa, when we have municipalities that are actually developing the people, is there no tension between your indigenous system as well as the local municipalities in Ghana? That's the question that I just wanted to ask you.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. to one of my colleagues in the bank in New Jersey, and the professor, or the expert from Ghana, for the engagement. I know that this is what we have to pass at the end of the meeting also. Now, there's just a few questions and comments. The first question, Mr. Question, is about the utilization of local resources. Now, part of these resources are people. There is an old concept in South Africa. It is not across. In Zulu is called the Lima, in Sesotho is called the Chima, and so on. Now this is this refers to a practice where people come together, plow together, and at the end of the season, reap together. And it's a very powerful concept. Now, I want to know whether in Ghana you have such an experience. And the question there would be, how is it used now in the modern environment? This concept is being utilized, and it's so hard. The other question, Jefferson, is really about the collaboration across religious groupings. Now, the experience as we see it, an experience through the media, television, etc., is really that there's a big tension between these groups in many countries. Maybe not in the majority of places, but it's something that's worth observing and then commenting on, I guess. For example, the killing of Christians and community members. People have been killed in big numbers by Boko Haram in Nigeria, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, and other similar groupings in countries like Mali, etc., including Al-Qaeda, and in war groups. So the question that I'm really asking is, how do you ensure religious harmony and working together in practice? In fact, very useful to find out if in Ghana you've had a Boko Haram experience, or Al-Shabaab experience, or Al-Qaeda experience. The other issue is the question of the alienation of youth. Now, all of us know that young people get alienated, easily get alienated, and this is an experience not just of Africa, across the world. Communities go through this kind of an experience. So I'd like to know, because you mentioned it in your presentation, how, at a practical level, in rural areas and similar places, this question of alienation has been dealt with. And the last question, Chairperson, is the question of harmful practices, which we have mentioned in your presentation. Now, in South Africa, we've just gone through a period where these things have really come up in the open. People being made its snakes by some of the Catholic churches,
eat grass, drink petrol, and so on. And women dealing with it in a particular way. Are there specific harmful practices that we have experienced in Ghana? And how have these been dealt with? Things that were being phased out or dealt with as outmoded type practices?
Thank you very much, Honorable Minister. I start from the last one. The practice is when I said, I like the way you said that some of the religious denominations, you know, they belong to a council, but I can say from authority that not all of them are part of it. So then you have those people who still go out and do. And you see, it's about, I believe so much. I was born an Anglican and then became a charismatic, and I'm now a vegetarian. I've seen different shapes of it. You know, but I learned from an Anglican bishop from Uganda. He came to visit in Ghana and he said, it's not the one who shouts or the one who prays quietly who is able to touch God, but the one who sincerely communicates with God. And so, I agree with you, but you find people drinking the water from, the bathroom water, from the man of God. On their own volition, they go with gallons, they go with bottles and collect it. But I believe so much that the churches are not doing too well. Because when you are in a house and your mother has food in the house, you won't go out to go and look for food. So much, I believe so much that there's hunger in our churches. That's why some of our members. But you also have an itching ears problem. So people, Bible says that, so people will go and still want to hear something different from somewhere. And they will land themselves into those troubles. So those things are still going on in Ghana. But the council of religious bodies are on top of that. Sometimes you find out they'll be arguing on television or on radio, and then you can have a display of power. If you do, I will do this. You know, and then you can judge for yourself that these people are not really operating from God or from the God some of us belong to. Talking about rituals or rites, there's one that comes into mind readily. We call it the dipo. Dipo is a cultural rite, a puberty rite for young girls in the Krobo area in Ghana, in the east wing of Ghana. The way they were operating that is, it's a period for cultural education, but normally, or before then, the women, the girls are almost naked. The camera's almost naked. They only have the underparts covered, but they're covering the top. You know, and with the practice that was held, and if you don't go through, then you don't become a Krobo woman. You are not of age because you have not gone through the rite. The Queen Mother realized that the candidates were not coming. So they went to the mill, and then they had complaints from the churches that it's privilege, you know, and the university girls would not come into it. Because in case a colleague or something, somebody says that I'm going to do people, and I come and I feel my duty then, in this age of WhatsApp and Facebook and everything. You know, so they were not coming. So the Queen Mother did was to appeal to the traditional authority, the paramount chief. And yes, this ceremony or this ritual is not about unity, it's about cultural education. So the paramount chief plays a very important role here. Because they can look at this custom and call it practice and amend them or improve upon them. And so they did. Now they cover the upper parts, they cover the lower parts. You know, and the essence is the cultural education. What makes me an African girl coming from that village is what you are living through for 1 month. So you come out and you know yourself. You know where you belong. And we're supposed to be drinking water from a pond. The pond now is very dirty because of bad environmental practices. Again, the traditional council was able to sit at distance, and they have drilled a borehole there. So the people go through the sacred practices, but they also go through the cultural education. And that is how I believe we can continue to some of these things. I must compare that the female segregation continues to be a challenge, because we are not taking a bold step as a country to address it. The women are part of the traditional areas. The women who perpetrate those things are part of it. They are actually the people who implement it. And we believe so much that it's time that we engage the paramount. Because God, you are not Lord that is trying to do that. But you are not in the community. And they believe in it, so they will do it. But then when we address, just like the way the people was addressed, and now the nudity is not coming out again. I believe so much that. And that's why we say that use the indigenous knowledge as the foundation. Bring in appropriate external knowledge to build on that, to reform it, to democratize the system. You know, and I believe that when we do that, we should be able to get there. Religious groupings. Thank you, Honorable Member. But fortunately, Boko Haram did not get in my country. But seriously, there have been some comments. And I'm glad to say that both the Muslim community and the Christian community, you know, deal with that. You know, sorry to say, but some of your politicians, in their quest to win power, they come out and say all sorts of things. You know, then you have these bodies who are very, there's a very good collaboration between the imams and the bishops and reverend in Ghana. And they try to leave it straight away in the back. They don't allow you to degenerate into. So we are still there. They have the interreligious bodies, something which is working very seriously. Now, talking about some of the traditional practices, again with agriculture, we have what we call the Nobua groups. So it's a group of young men who come together and they will work for you today, tomorrow work for another person. This, you know, so they do that. And what we are doing as an organization is spending their capacity. So they don't just work for, so after working for people when they sit idle, is there an income generating activity they can achieve? You know, because it's an institution, and how can we make that institution very strong and active? But we have it in Ghana, and they are very useful when it comes to the farming season. The relationship between the district assemblies and the traditional authorities. The district assemblies are responsible for the overall development of the area, within the area, within the district. The traditional authorities know their role. Their role is the traditional governance of their people. So in most areas, there are no big conflicts. Everybody knows his boundary. The district assemblies will come to the traditional authorities, and they know that where they are supposed to support them. But what we are trying to promote, and that is the indigenous development concept, is for the assemblies to realize that the traditional area is on its own journey. And there are ways that we can work with our chiefs. And then they can be okay for us. For instance, I'm sorry to use this example. In the Bible, when David went after somebody's wife, the prophet came. The prophet didn't say, "You are a wicked man. You have done A, B, C, D." But he's a parable. And at the end of the story, the king said, "That person must die." And he said, "You are the one." And he saw that remorse because of the way he went about it. And I think we have developed a methodology for engaging traditional authorities. Our culture, and we have come here, Honorable Chairperson and members, you have your system. You need to respect your system. We can't come here and say that, no, I mean, they're all South Africans, so we can talk anyhow, we can. When my dad was going to speak to you, he got here and realized that, no. So he turned back and went to speak to my sister before he got to you. We have that system, we have the structure. The chief should have called it the fair respect. But some of us don't know the protocols. We don't know that. One of the mistakes we make early part of our work was to provide a bench for peace. Where did it go? I mean, a chief is a chief. Sorry, we are here. But a chief is a chief. You know, so chairs is for people to sit down. And we had organized a meeting, and the main organizer was one of the chief actually, but he was coming to his area. But the one who was supposed to bring the plastic chair didn't do a good organization, so he delayed it. And other chiefs have come from the district. And then we saw two benches being used by some youth. And we appealed to them to give us one to give to the chiefs. And they gave us, but he added an agreement. But because it don't come from the area, we didn't understand. He said, if they wouldn't sit on it. You know. So we brought a chair, and the chair was in the middle, and we were just dancing, playing, marching. We call it dancing, but we just facing at them, front and back, without sitting on it. Then we thought that because the chair, it was only one bench. That's why. So we then brought another one. And the chief said, thank you. And the gentlemen were very curious watching at that. Not knowing chiefs don't sit on bench. So when we got into the room and started the meeting, they said, gentlemen, chiefs don't sit on benches. A bench is classified as a stool. So when you sit on benches, you are sharing your stool. And you don't share your stool with anybody. But they didn't know. So we liked it. So there was no way we are going to give a bench, you know. If you go to church and there are benches, yes, no one's church. No one is another person's church. She's never what I'm saying. So then they sit on it. But if you give them, so those are the things we learned the hard way. Some of the things we're talking about are things that we experience. And so if we use appropriate means, a rush presentation, but we've developed so many tools, and that is what we are promoting. This concept of industrial development is being done in Latin America, in Asia, you know, and in Africa. Africa, you have Tanzania, Uganda, and West Africa, a lot of countries are promoting it. And we believe that if we adopt it as our development practice, that really builds on what already exists, we'll be able to do away with a lot of these challenges that are coming up. And so I want to reiterate that we are talking about the geographical area of the traditional council. The traditional council covers a certain geographical area. It's responsible for the land that is within that. And also there's a hierarchy. So if you don't understand the hierarchy, we went to traditional council and we're holding a body of, we are not seven because we're going to seven traditional council within a district. And then we went to the first three. And then we noticed that they accepted, they don't comment, you know. Then somebody told us, you don't give a bottle of snap to the paramount chief, you give two. So then the next one we had to go, we had to double. So we had to pick somebody else snap and add. When they saw us coming with the two bottles of snap, they brought one to the president who had to welcome us. And all the other three didn't mind us. They just took it. And then they said you offer traditional prayers. The other thing didn't do it. So we learned from that one. You know, but then when you're going to the traditional chief and the lower chief, you give a bunch of stuff. So we need to understand where these people are coming from and know that there is hierarchy and there is space, a geographical space, you know, that we need to. And then understand also, in some traditional areas in Ghana, you have this tool. Sometimes you take paramount chief. Belongs just one stool. There could be other stools. And when royalties are shared, they are shared among the stools. You know. And so you, the primary chief, you can't take somebody's stools. There was a case in Ghana like that, and that led to some alunta. I don't know what it is. But confusion, serious confusion. And the chief had to run away. Because he had been sleeping on people's money. Because they didn't know. You know. But then those guidelines are not clear. And they are eliminating those practices. Yes, the state power. There was a question around. I don't know if I've left any the question I've left. Yeah, the issue of decision.
The question of and then the question of claim. The question of plowing together. I think, and the other extension of
the youth. Okay. So the plowing together is what I've explained, that the youth have what we call a Inobua group. Inobua is in southern Ghana. They call it Kota group in the northern Ghana. And these are groups that do those works. And that's what I'm saying, that we try to encourage them. That beyond the farming season, where they plow, where they weed before, prepare the land for each other, they do something more with their lives, you know. And also the youth. Fortunately, our festivals have been very strong in Ghana. And everybody wants to go to a festival or another. So when I come from a traditional area and there's a festival, my friends want to come along. And that is a period where you have the cultural education going on. In fact, beyond that, we are eating euphemic, or the Queen Mother's tradition is to revitalize traditional food. And so you find them preparing old dishes that for 50 years people are not thinking about them. So during that period, there's no fried rice, no, none of those modern stuff. But Asian food that we call Asian food, because people are not thinking about it. And then they will eat it, and they will like it. And then that begins the journey towards the cultivation of these crops, you know. So that's what I can say about that one. The issue of power. So in Ghana, there are some cases that can be handled by the traditional control. It's well set up. And there are some, they don't have things around theft, things around murder. There are certain cases they can't handle at the traditional control level. And you have a right also to say that, no, I don't want the case to be handled at the traditional level. I want to go to the police and do that. But they are clear that, in fact, what they have been doing is they train a lot of the chiefs of Queen Mothers, especially the Queen Mothers, on this alternate dispute resolution mechanism. And it's very strong in that. They really take them to this paradigm stuff, and they are doing very well. But there are cases that are handled solely by the courts. And whatever, sometimes they can come to the point where they say that we want to go and settle this thing in court, out of court. We want to go to meet the traditional leader and settle this thing. So when they do, they have to bring back a report. The traditional leader will have to send a report to the court before the issue is controlled. So there are those opportunities, but everybody knows it's left for this life, you know, which regards the authority and power.
No, colleagues, you must also allow the presentation is with us already. Surely the colleagues from Ghana. I think the colleague from Ghana is always coming to South Africa, I guess, from time to time.
This is his first time in Cape Town. Not even from Africa, but in Cape Town. Second, I'm sure he's second, but he was actually on the West Coast, so he wasn't really in Cape Town, but he says he was in Cape Town, so I want to shoot him. But yes, he is definitely available to support us in the process. He has made himself available, and so we have that commitment here.
And also, I think we have raised our bill. This is just a bill really for discussion by other communities. I think we would bear some presentation to that bill one day. When you look at the situation in Ghana and try some of the issues. And I can see also in your presentation there's plug in and plug out, and plug in and out, I think is a good area. That maybe we should also consider having a discussion on. But the point that is always been raised that it's very difficult to democratize traditional system of government. It seems you are saying not at all. You can democratize them. And because it's an issue that is always there. This is the get rid of it anyway, because you can't democratize it. And the unelected people who sit there, they don't account to anyone. And whatever decision that they take is a very selfish decision. There are always a lot of accusations against the traditional system of government, sometimes for practical reasons. But since we are saying, now the system can run, if we allow the original side of the internal development of the system, we can be able to democratize. think we're going to engage on this issue as we deal with our appeal. And I think your views will be highly appreciated. And considering that we must learn from your experience, I think we've been having this system for some time now. In the democratized form, not really in the old form. But in a democratized form, I think would be very helpful for us to do so. I know that the president tomorrow is opening a house of traditional leaders here. I think they'll be sitting here anyway. And I'm told those potential traditional leaders are set down. They will be sitting here and then for the opening. No, we know what I think is a very important presentation. And thank you for the presentation. But also thank you for you gave us documentation to read. And I guess we are going to be engaging for many years from now. And, even now that the bill has been passed by the chamber, I think there are a lot of things. The Director General for Traditional Affairs also here, who was also responsible for the traditional leadership, and then he's here also because he wanted to listen to your input. So all of us, we want to learn from your experience. We take the view of indigenous way of doing things. That is very important also. Take what is positive from the development of many years, this cutting of not positive. I think we are going to engage with you and see what we can do. I know that my son always visits Ghana. When he's in Accra, he may also call you and have a discussion about the potential traditional leadership. I know that in Johannesburg now also the very potential traditional leader. Because my son is saying that traditional leadership can't be boundary-based. It should be a jurisdiction rather than a boundary. And since we are going to have them everywhere now, yeah, that is a view that is going to be expressed. Thank you very much, and hopefully you will remain with us. And when we engage with our national council, because we are engaging with them especially because they are also a very important stakeholder in terms of the bill that is before us. It's always good to engage and to differ earlier on but the process that we are going to follow. Therefore, we have engaged with them, we are going to visit all provinces and engage with the traditional leadership there, engage with women organizations there, engage with young people there, really discussion South African about the traditional system of traditional leadership and how do we do. How do we improve it? When do we need to improve? What is that we can learn from it that needs to be built to make sure that it remains relevant for many years to come? And then we're going to be engaged in all provinces, from the eastern part of the country to the northern part, the western part, and southern part of the country. And so we'll be always open for discussion with you and whatever view that you want to express with the bill, I think we'll be free to do so. The secretary of the committee is here. But that's also always available, I guess. We are not going to miss a call. And then we'll be always be linking up even a discussion on this matter. Thank you very much for this presentation. Very helpful for us and learning a lot from your experience in Ghana. Let me then invite the traditional, the national council to have an engagement with the committee. National chairperson, you are there. Yes, ma'am.
In my call, there is no issue that we are addressing now. But thank you for the first time. I also want to say thank you very much for you and the honorable members for getting me the opportunity to do this. I would just send you a full something on endogenous development for your wider reading. And I also present a copy of the charter. It's also on the internet. I think on the list you'll find it. But I want to give an official copy to you. And thank you very much on that one.
Thank you very much. We'll continue our education on these matters. National chairperson, don't you want to come a little bit in front?
Yes,
de la chemin du sud de la mer. And welcome again, the colleagues who have just arrived, and most welcome. We must resume our Ms. Nasha, you want to make a presentation? And we are here to listen what the issues want to raise it up. Thank you for coming. And if you do wish to introduce the leadership for him, is that you are.
Representing the Nama or Nama people of good morning. I am Mashifans Krausuk, the Secretary of the National Royal Shan Council, a representative from Free State Province, representing the Griqua community. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to take this opportunity to tell you more about the National Croatian Council. The National Croatian Council is an ad hoc forum, ad hoc body, that was formed or established in 1999. And the person who initiated the establishment of this forum was the late President Nelson Mandela. I will say a little more about him and his involvement a little bit later. The National Croatian Sand Council comprises of five historical Croatian Sand communities or people that existed for thousands of years in South Africa as stated in the official government reports called the Status Quo Reports. As I entered the building this morning, I saw on the walls all that testify to this, that the Croatian Sand been here for thousands of years. Printed on the walls. The five main groupings are the San, the Bikoa, the Nama, the Cape Koi, and the Kurana. Each of the five main communities have their subgroupings who are represented also on the National Croatian Council. The National Croatian Council for 17 years comprised these elected communities through the status quo reports. Now, the status quo reports is in short just research that has been done and commissioned by the late president and under the auspices of the Department of Justice at that time, the Department of Constitutional Development. And each of the groupings, the five groupings, were then researched, and they later combined the research papers and formed one consolidated report that is called the Status Quo Report. This, for all the 17 years, the council consists of comprised of 21 members. But after 2011, or during 2011, there were a lot of other groups, other survivalist groups, who came forward and the claim that the council don't represent them, because they only recently, during that time, became organized structures. Then the Department of Traditional Affairs, in cooperation with the National Croatian Council, agree and to ask the minister to extend the council's membership from 21 to 30 to also include these people who claim that they were not represented. I especially mention this, explain this, because today there are still people who say that they are not represented by the National Croatian Council. And the Director General, Professor Kuala, sitting here, can testify to this, that he went through the whole of the country and we invited the communities that claimed not to be represented. And after that, we extended the council to 30 members. So we believe that it is the representative of the Croatian people of South Africa. The next slide is just to give you an idea of the geographical areas that are represented by the council. So you just have a look there. The KwaZulu-Natal one includes Kopstad and East Griqua.
as I explained earlier, is to say that the president then realized that there is a lack of a formal structure that he and his government can use as a communication channel to negotiate with the Khoisan people in South Africa. So he then urged his Department of Justice or Constitutional Development to establish a council for that purpose. The mandate that was given to this council was to negotiate the constitutional accommodation of the Khoisan people in the different spheres of government. This development was preceded by a meeting called by the late President Mandela at his official residence in Nadendal in 1995. At that occasion, he met with key leaders of the Khoisan to discuss the needs and the shortfalls of the Khoisan peoples in post-apartheid South Africa. He also asked us to draw up a memorandum to highlight our concerns in that regard. It was way back in 1995. And what's the aim of the National Muslim Council? Our aims are to join our fellow African leaders, traditional leaders, and traditional communities in the recognized legislative framework as set out in the traditional and Khoisan leadership. Secondly, to ensure the recognition of our associated traditional knowledge to certain indigenous biological resources. Here we refer to issues or products such as rooibos and fufu and all that biological resources. And I'm sure you all know about this whole issue of rooibos and fufu. It's a big issue in South Africa. It's a big issue internationally at the moment. And we claim to have the primary traditional knowledge on that products. To advocate for the developmental and human rights concerns of the Khoisan and Pan communities. And to ensure the Khoisan languages, as far as possible, becomes official languages. To address the historical land issues of the Khoisan, we want to make it clear here that we know that this bill is not a bill that addresses the land, but we just want to make the link here. And that's important for us. Because indigenous or traditional leadership can have no authority if they don't have land. And this is about the authority of traditional leaders and their communities and how will they exercise that authority if there's no land. And that's why we want to notify that we want a link to be made to that issue. The body that I have introduced to you now has come into the chamber today and addressed this portfolio committee to convey a very powerful message. You now know who the National Coalition Council is. You know who are represented by this council. You know a little bit more, I hope, about this council. So this council came in here to say that we support the traditional and Khoisan leadership role. And we want it to be enacted without further delay. And I want to stick some of these because of lack of time. There was this situation where the United Nations commissioned its special rapporteur on indigenous issues to visit South Africa in 2005. And this special rapporteur of the United Nations came here to familiarize him with the situation on the ground of the Khoisan people in South Africa. And he presented a very comprehensive report to the South African government on his findings on that mission. And this is just some of the issues that he addressed. But I will ask my colleague, Ms. Johnson, later on in this time, to reflect a little bit more on the visit of the special rapporteur. I then want to go straight to the other, toward the end of this presentation, the National Koyushan Council's analysis of importance of the traditional Koyushan Council Law 2015. We want to say that we support the creation of a law that recognizes African customary communities, institutions, and regions. We want to make that quite clear. We support the creation of such a law. We also believe that African customary institutions and its leadership should be compliant with the democratic principles of our Constitution of 1996. That says a lot. And sitting here, we are not sure exactly how, and we know this is a big question, we know it's a very controversial issue, how to marry these two institutions. And, but we say that we as the Koyushan people, we really want to be compliant with our democratic principles as set out in our Constitution. So we want the system of the customary system, the traditional system, to evolve and not radically, not revolutionary, but to evolve towards a balance between that two institutions. We also believe that African customary institutions and its leadership should be compliant. No, I already said. We therefore believe that the bill is important and has a place in post-apartheid South Africa. We also believe it is in line with the African policy frameworks of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. So it's not only the South African issue. We know that this bill is in line with the policy frameworks of the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. And we already discussed this bill with representatives from the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. Now, the National Koyushan Council formula for a successful collective existence of African communities, which includes the Koyushan. Based on the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the African Commission's report on the issue of indigenous peoples, if we are here to survive and thrive as a customary community based on our collective values. To do that, it needs the following three key foundations as set out there. We need land for that. We need geographical jurisdiction over our territories. We need hierarchical leadership. I don't know whether I pronounced that big word correctly, but we need that. At this point, I must tell you who I am. I come from a people, a community, an indigenous movement called the Griqua National Conference of South Africa. We, as a movement, as an indigenous Christian movement, Griqua movement, survived the onslaught of evil regimes of colonialism and apartheid. We survived that. That systems, as we all know, tried to destroy the Koyushan and other indigenous groups and the traditional communities' existence in terms of culture, traditions, language, institutions, etc. We know that that regime was aimed at destroying that among all our indigenous groups, including Koyushan people. Now, for us, the Griqua National Conference, we have this story, and I use this, it's not the only model, but I use this because it's my own, and I can explain it much better. And that is the diagram that you see up there. Our structure set out like that. We national, a national traditional council. It will be in a national traditional council. We then have branches, and we only listed four there, but we have branches in many of the provinces in South Africa, different branches. So, if you know the content of the bull, you will know that the bull speaks to the issue of branches in the koinsan part of the bull, section of the bull. And we do have that branches. So, if you take branch one, in branch one, we will have a chief. And we will also have different community bodies, traditional customer bodies. That is a youth body as a body for human, for women, a body for men, etc. We will have certain bodies in that branch under the auspices of the chief. And if you go from branch 1 to branch 4, you will get exactly the same. It is exactly the same. You will get the chief, the same bodies. And in all of the branches, it's the same. There's one branch situated along the southern coast, or south coast, Plettenberg, near Plettenberg Bay, just outside of the town of Plettenberg Bay, called Transhoek, which is a historical Griqua settlement. And that's the headquarters of the Griqua National Conference. Now, the chief that is the chief of branch 1 and the chief of branch 2, 3, and 4 will have representation in the National Traditional Council. So each of them will have representation in the National Traditional Council. So if there are 12 branches or 100 branches, there will be a council will consist of that amount of chiefs that will sit in that traditional council. And the head of that council, the traditional council, is the paramount chief. And all of the things that happen in branch 1 stand under the authority of the national traditional council. So the paramount chief can visit any of their branches, and he can then oversee the activities of that branch and make sure everything is done in the same customary way. So the different community bodies, as well as the chief, remains under the auspices of the paramount chief. And the paramount chief and the traditional council, the national traditional council, will hold the chief in branch 1, 3, or 4, and the community bodies. They will hold them responsible to uphold the set of distinct values and principles of the Griqua National Conference. And these people will come to meetings of the national traditional council and will report on the developments in their branches, and their discussions will flow from that. So the reason why I did this is just to show you that we have a system that works from the bottom to the top. It is not that the branch 1 or branch 3 operate in isolation. It is not in isolation. It's not a community of its own. It's a community that is linked, attached paramount. If that respect is absent, then this will start eroding the system underneath. This system worked for the Griqua National Conference for many generations. The Griqua National Conference, as an organization, as a movement, was established in 1904 in Maitland, in Cape Town, not far from. And ever since, even before the fight, ever since, we uphold this system. And it is still thriving today, it is still working today, it is developing today, and it resisted the onslaught, or many onslaughts, up till now. So we can say that this is a proven example of how you can exercise authority from a central point of authority to different branches, to different layers of governments. It works, it can work, and it worked for us. The next thing I want to highlight is that this system that I've introduced to you now will last, but it does not mean that there were not problems with that system. It doesn't mean that all was just roses. A lot of things happened in the meantime. And we believe that if that system was not there, and if that system will not be there in future, and we will not have ownership over our traditional lands for the necessary geographical authority, it will impact very negatively on us. It will impact on the security of us as a collective survival, as an African power, as a collective survival, as an African cultural community. It will, that system, that structure, help us to maintain our cultural identity. Because the Griqua identity, ever since the 1700s, ever since the 1800s, 1900s, 2000, the Griqua identity, when we maintained our identity as Griqua, the history of South Africa is clear on that. The history of the Griqua people is well documented. The same with other groups, such as the Nama and the Sand, etc. A lot has been written about it. So, what we are trying to say is that the Khoisan people did not just revive after 1994. We've been there before 1994. We've been there long before 1994. And we survived the onslaught. And I think if I compare this with the other traditional institutions, then there's a lot of similarities between them. Our cultural heritage, we succeeded in protecting our cultural heritage to a large extent. Our languages, unfortunately, the Khoisan languages, have been destroyed excessively. But over the past few years, a lot has been done to try to revive the Khoisan language. In terms of education, it's also a big problem. Because the schools, in the history books, you don't even read about, in the apartheid years, you did not read in history books about the Griqua people. Only here and there you have a page referring to. So, the next thing I want to, the example I want to explain to you is that we
village of Kranshoek near Edinburgh Bay. I'll take that as an example. After 1995, and I think it was on about 2003 when the new Municipal Demarcation Act came into power, and where Kranshoek was a Greek settlement, suddenly became an open space for everybody to reside. We had our own school, clinic, and nursery school, etc. in that village. And we have got the Greek National Conference has got commemoration days, festivals. And when we commemorate having a festival, then on that day, the school will participate in that. Because the school worked together with community to develop the culture, the tradition, and the institution of the Greek people. The schools played a vital role in that. What happened now is that people from all over flocked into council and they are now living there. So we do not have any jurisdiction anymore in terms of cultural education, heritage practice, etc. in schools, in the curriculum of the school, or as part of the school day. Because they called it a brand new school in Kranshoek. And everybody that wants to come there can now be part of, can be enrolled in that school. It's no more like a school, a Greek school, that upholds the Greek values and principles. People from all over around Pleasant Bay are now buried in the cemetery in Council. And that cemetery was for the Greek people a sacred site. But it's almost sacred site. Because everybody can now be buried there. And it's not that we want to isolate it, but we got to isolate our culture and our tradition to protect. If we don't do that, how can we protect? So that is a threat that we now encounter in present-day South Africa. And that speaks to the need to have your own authority, your own geographical authority, to make sure that your institutions, your culture, your traditions will survive the onslaught of time. And if that is not there, the whole system will fall apart. And that is clearly happening there. And that's a living example of the threat of that type of a threat. And that's why we believe that the poll must recognize this and must recognize the need to protect this. And also this is to explain that the Khoi San people support the poll because the poll must address these issues. With that, I want to close my presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Leshma Sepas. I think we will be engaging. It's not the last time anyway we're engaging. We'll continue to engage on some of the issues that we are raising. Unless there are critical areas, honorable members, that you want to pose, and we'll allow you that space. But as we are very qualified, this is just a first meeting amongst many meetings that we are still going to have. Because as we visit all provinces, I think National Share surely, there will be communities that you will present in many provinces. And surely they will come to our public hearings and then have a discussion. And I think your views may also be expressed at that particular level.
interpretation, very last part of it. He said that the grants book now have it now sounds as if there are some people there. I don't know on what basis that because of cultural possession, you need a unique community in the Pequa community. Apparently, you are saying there are people who are not mainly a Pequa, and therefore you feel that your cultural practices and other things will actually not be well articulated because there are these people outside, so to say. And what you are asking the committee of government is that first one, and secondly, those people, the outsiders, must be removed from trans. Is that what you are saying? Okay.
Sometimes there was once a presentation that begins to say that part of the problems we have with the cold and the sun is that we do not have available data that we can trace these communities because of the manner in which their origin was destroyed by the colonizers. But if you have an institution that has lived for 100 years, almost 100, you're talking 100. No, you said 1904. If you have an institution that has lived for more than 100 years, that's generation on its own, why we are unable to then, with a generation of 100 years, able at least to trace the basis of the existence, even if there's nothing we can but this generational transfer of knowledge in terms of my understanding. One could have made that, but you would have it in the pondos, you would have it in the other people. And secondly, how do you think we will resolve the issue of geographical location? Because many tribes and many people in South Africa were involved because of the colonization and the apartheid colonialism, which have destroyed all of them. You cannot find them where to locate them. Can't we, as a nation, accept that our past is brutal, that we cannot go back and try and find a geographical space, that we live in the space of South Africa? Can't we live within the context of that? Or does that go hand in hand with the fact that people want to claim for their open spaces of land, that people want to legitimate claim? And if you have a claim, you do not understand your historical geographical claim and cannot identify whatever you want to claim. Because I think the contradiction and the differences might lie within that. You have 21 years for instance of existence as a council. What have you achieved in that 21 years in terms of moving forward for us to get to where we are? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I can say this is a very old concept, Chair. When last was it in the which month? Since I know you mentioned that you were elected in 1999. When last did you get the mandate? Secondly, which part or area that you want to identify as your head office or where you want to practice as a college center, where you want to practice your cultural activity? Did you spot a certain area that you are targeting? I can see you mentioned a number of provinces.
each province to have a certain land that is dedicated for Khoisa, how is this going to be done? And lastly, I was looking at your organogram here. Your organogram, it says the first level of traditional council is the paramount chief. But I can see the headquarters is below that. I don't know whether the headquarters is part of the paramount chief or the headquarters got similar powers with your branches. How do you think that? Because I'm looking at your branch one and your headquarters is in the same line. Maybe you sit at a executive. But when you say your headquarters will be controlling some of the branches, I don't know about branch four because that one remains under branch one. I did not get the logic under this structure that you have drawn for us. To me, I thought the headquarters would be sitting there on the top of the traditional council with your paramount and underneath are your branches. Are your branches as well what you call, what we call provinces or region or the name that you, or the area that you have named here, is that what you regard as branches that will have each chief that will be sitting in a council? If you may explain that to me, I would appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. I'll start with the last one. The name, the places that are listed there, is not the branches of the organization that I used as an example. It's not, that is not the branches of the Griqua National Conference. That's the branches of the National Cohesion Council that is listed. But likewise, the Griqua National Conference have got its branches in many of that areas as a subgrouping of the bigger Khoisan movement. This means the headquarters, our headquarters, and that is, I use the example from my own organization. They are not all the same. They differ because the Khoi and San are different groupings and they have different cultural practices also. And I assume the same with the Zulu and the Khoisa and them. It's not the same at the Khoisa village as it is the Zulu village. That's the type of example that I use. So the one I used was my own organization. It's not to say that all of them will operate in the same way. And I use that one because I can speak to them, because it's just my own business. But the headquarters, yes, where the paramount is on, that's where the headquarters is. So if the paramount is on in Colesburg, then the headquarters will shift in that area. So the other thing that you've asked is how you link the branches. Of course, the paramount is in crowns of the districts, and the different branches are at different places in the country. But the national council, the national traditional council, can have their settings in different areas of the country. It's not necessarily that they have their settings in France. They can have it in any other place. Because it's just not people from France, but people from all the different regions, from all the different France, make up the national council. So is there anything on the table?
I just think that some of the areas really would engage continuously. And colleagues who are around and who are part of your delegation, they can also come in wherever they want to come in and explain some of the areas of work. Because this is the first meeting, we are still going to have many, many other meetings. We may not exhaust every point and question today. I think to today I just laid the foundation for bigger public hearings. And naturally, will be also some discussion, even if you are through our public hearings. Because I just laid the foundation there, it's not our purpose. We may not exhaust every branch, who has this branch, and what is this branch, where the overall king or queen. And then I think at a structural level would work. But I think the main purpose really was just to have an input on the side about a bill that is before all of us. I think we have already taken a very positive view on the bill that will support it. And of course, there are areas here and there in the bill that we may need them to improve. But broadly, I think in terms of representation, support the bill. And then you also view that you should speed up the implementation of the bill. I know that there have been a lot of questions, Bama, on the if the understanding and everything. I think we emphasized it last time. That is South Africa is we are a product of many streams, historical and cultural. And then naturally we have multiple identities. I know that Professor Mawela supports what was that African Wanderers. And also I support African Wanderers. We identify ourselves on supporting African Wanderers. But we are product of many streams generally. All cultural and also but then overarching here could have thought share that and then we are all African. That is the overall arching area field, our identity, the ultimate identity. And then, of course, that's the human as another area. We are African people within this broad community. There will be lots of streams. I would have thought that Khoi, Shen, Lama, Griqua are part of these broader streams. They're not separate. From a broad identity of being Africans, and just dreams of one big pool of people. Because it's important that we do that, because once we start creating some confusion in our mind, I think I would make the position at all. It makes it difficult then to understand exactly what you're trying to do. I think the point that we're raising, that within this traditional system of governance, we have people who see it's a suit. To speak many African languages. They are part of these streams anyway, but the identity overall is one. I would have thought that that's how we're handling it. That also next to share, since we are taking that posture, that in these streams, of course, it's a melting pot, and all of us, we are products of this. It's ever changing, ever developing, sir. And then we're producing a South African nation. That would be non-racial, non-sexist, democratic, prosperous, and then prosperous and united. I thought that is the overall thing that we are trying to do, and the bill will be able to articulate to us that. And then the bill become our behavior of achieving that, and making the community that was not really accommodated in terms of the current views of national, traditional, house of traditional leadership. And then this bill specifically is trying to take the Khoi and Swain and other colleagues to that level. And the point that I always worried about, I'm not sure whether we have taken a view that as this country, the ultimate aim of the country is to be part of the broader house, national house of traditional leaders. Because that's an issue that always confuses me too. Whether you want to have a separate house that is not part of the broader house. President is opening that house tomorrow. National house. I would have thought that you are part general. Once they build the law and everything we have done, you will be part of the house of traditional leaders in South Africa. Within that, you will be part of one stream of it. It's not a separate house. Simply means that when the president assesses the house of traditional leadership national is one house, and all these houses are part of this bigger one house. I think that's the point. Sure, you were articulating, as far as I hear you very well. And then it's easy for us then to work when we understand the fact, what is it that we are trying to achieve. Les wanted to make a point. I saw you raise your hand.
Thank you very much, Chair, and honourable members, for the question. I think it's such an important question. I think the issue of the inclusion of the Korean son into the system, so that the law recognizes what was also historically has gone wrong, what has socially gone wrong, what has politically even gone wrong. And I think the last meeting that I attended with the Korean Council was that they want to form part, the inclusion represents becoming part of a broader African community in South Africa. And the sense, what I know of them, being from those communities as well, is that the idea is for them to form part with our African communities with due consideration that our past has totally separated us. So I can assure the House that is also the position where the Korean Sound community comes from. Pertaining the Council, if you would permit me, I just want to make a few points. It as a headquarters, I think it could also be just a matter of language, because English is a foreign language. But I think the issue there is about culture. It's about customary law. It is about the Greek people wanting to be able to manage their sacred sites and having a say on how that is managed. Because I think our colleagues from Ghana is a very important thing. We are a few constellations as African people. We're spiritual, we're the material, and we're the social. So I think in Mr. Lafayette's articulation of his issue of culture, it's that cultural, it's that spiritual constellation which they are concerned about as fellow African people that's going lost. Because a simple thing, which might seem small, is a big thing of their leader, whose burial site is on a commercial farmer's land. And they, on a yearly basis, have a pilgrimage to his grave site, where something like 4,000 people come, and they pay homage to that leader. That's a sacred site which you don't have access to. So they want to be able to say, this is our site, we want to manage it, we want to bring our people here, we want to have the authority to look after it. And as a cultural community, they've welcomed all cultures. In fact, they integrate very well with different streams, and I appreciate the streams point. And I think this is one community that has totally shown the Khoisan, is an example for the Khoisan, of how we should reconnect with our African beingness and our fellow African people. So I think for them, it's that culture of managing the customs, managing the culture, managing the spirituality. They don't have a say over the grey sites. It is, we all know as Africans that is fundamental to us. So I think that's what we hope this committee will take away from this discussion. More in terms of authority, in terms of managing the culture, as opposed to disconnecting them from the rest of Africa. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
It's about protection, because if we don't protect it, who will protect? And so we want to really, if the municipality wants to bury people from far outside that village, in our village cemetery, that they consult with us, that they get our approval for doing so. Because we see that, just an example, we see that graveyard as a graveyard where we want to go, because all the people that are lying there are our ancestors, our community ancestors. It will become an open graveyard, and it will lose its cultural value for us. So it's also part of our heritage. It's a heritage site for us, a sacred heritage site, our graveyard. And that's the way we view it. And I think that's not a strange viewing in terms of African custom, African custom as well. That's the type of points that we want to make. The same applies to the schools, where we community must contribute to upholding the values of that specific community. And it's a Nama school, it must uphold the Nama values and try to develop Nama culture and traditions within the school curriculum, making space for that within the curriculum. And that we believe will help us to enhance, not only enhance, but to secure our generational to pass it on to the different generations. And we, as I've explained, we have tested it over generations and it works, but suddenly it's beginning to tumbling in because things are changing rapidly and we want to be in control of that change. And that's the point that I want to make. In terms of removing the outsiders, who asked that question? That's not the issue. And this is the explanation. It is our right to exercise our traditional, our customary practices, our so that we can have the say. It's not that we want them to pay up and go now, because the government or the municipality brought them in there. They are now there and they are settled there. We cannot remove them now. But if they move into that space, they must be part of that community. They must not be elements of disrupting the cultural development of that, the cultural practices of that community. It's difficult to deal with this. I don't know all the answers to it, but it is a challenge. And as far as the committee, with all its wisdom, can help us to overcome that issue, we will appreciate it. I think there was one. What did you achieve? The other was the no trace of knowledge. I don't know if I addressed this one correctly, but and if I understood it correctly, but I indicated earlier that the Gikwa history, and I speak again about the Gikwa history, the same applies to the Nama and other groups. The history is relevant, it's there. The community are there. The areas where they resided are there. It is documented from the early days of colonialism. It is well documented. So it's not that there's no knowledge, no trace about these people. They are there. It's just that apartheid and colonialism divided us, so that we don't know the history of our fellow people. And that's the big problem. So if we can move closer together, and I believe that this legislation, this act, will definitely bring us together. And when, Mr. Chair, when we sit together in that house, new relationships will evolve in that house. And not in that house, but the people sitting in that house are connected to different communities, and so we will reach out to different communities and we will learn much more about each other, and that is another advantage of being together in the house.
That is, I wouldn't tell you, I want to be traditionally then, sir, from Mbangi, and I think we'll leave that with you and have some discussion about traditional leadership issues. Now, I think, sir, again, thank you for coming. The meeting today was very fruitful, at least in my view. It has been assisting us to understand exactly what is the intention, and then what role we can play to ensure that we enhance the areas that we've already raised and speed up the passage of the bill. in order for us to start setting up this structure. And hopefully, sir, you'll be able to ensure that the community that is in the Eden Cape area of demarcation at the moment, they also participate in really provincial traditional leadership areas. And, because I think they will assist a lot to start engaging many other issues that are still outstanding issues. I don't think the bill will cover everything under the sun. The bill is in an attempt to raise the for Matiba's proclamation of the country that must address the destitution. And I think the college is more than prepared to speed up this. And of course, the public hearing may be longer than expected sometimes. And then a lot of people now want to participate fully on traditional leadership system. Women, the young persons, and Isbuna and other colleagues who are always participating in this. But I think we are going to link up with you and have some discussion and some advice, or as we try to finalize some of the areas that we have raised. Because it's important that we come out with a bill that accommodate everyone, and yourself well accommodated. And hopefully those who are living heritage rights also, they will address some of the issues that you are raising. Because they are very important areas that you are raising. And thank you for coming, and it assisted us a lot. And I think as we go to public hearing, at least we are well informed now about the entire community. And then what are the critical areas that are requesting, and then what we can do. And the general's idea, I think taking note also some of the areas that we were raising. I think members really should allow them now to remain. Of course, you're always invited to remain when the department is continuing with our meeting yesterday. We had a meeting yesterday with the department presenting the budget and other areas. If you do have time, we'd appreciate it if you remain. If again, hard class by time, we'll really appreciate also if you decide whatever. But we hope we'll be able to link up very soon. And have it as actually a secretary here, a new issue that you want to communicate to the committee. The secretary is here, you must be able to protect those. National Chair, I think I want to invite you to make your concluding remarks.
Thank you very much, Chair. There was one question that I feel that I must quickly respond to, and that was the question about the re-election of the NKC. I think it came from there. The NKC was re-elected in 2005 after 1999. 1999 was established, but it started to operate actually in 2000, so 5 years later it was re-elected. And then 2010, end of the process started to change the National Kosin Council's membership. So they reaffirmed the current office bearers and then elect new members to the council in 2011. After that, the argument from both the council and the department was that we are now on the doorstep of the bill going to parliament, where it is now. So what's the use of electing a new council now? We are waiting now for the outcome of the parliamentary process. So we do follow the rules and the regulations, and DG is here to confirm what I am saying. So, Mr. Chair, thank you so much. For us, it is an opportunity, and it was an opportunity to come here as an NKC to present to you and to explain to you our position, who we are, who we are, what is our position on certain issues, and most of all to come here to say that there may be other people who oppose the bill, but we support the bill, with, of course, having the right to still make some inputs and recommendations. So that was our main message that we wanted to convey, and I think we did that.
Well, thank you so much. And okay, colleagues, I think let us take 5 minutes Nobel Prize, and then the department will be ready to engage on our discussion. Happy that the other day. I think that's what you should do, colleagues. 5 minutes, body break, and then we sit down, and I think one of us will sit down and have a discussion. Okay? It'll be long and a very exciting meeting. We have enjoyed a lot of this meeting. We want to have more of this meeting, even when it is in place, just to have discussion and then assisting us to understand the challenges. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. number one.
The second one, I'm very concerned
about the issue of this fee. I don't know whether this time frame that is put here, that the next meeting really would approve the policy for us to be able to go forward with the fee. And you know, this is that there are children are dying there. And we've been delaying this issue. Are we ready, if you can say, in order for us to hold you accountable, it's unfortunate that the minister is not here, that the next cabinet meeting is going to sit and approve this policy for us to start the process of putting up the fee. Thank you very much.
There were areas that were reported yesterday on their progress report, but we are not getting as to what exactly has been done and how are they foreseeing resolving those matters. In particular, slide 11 and slide 12, we wanted to have a concrete plan as to how are these going to be addressed. There are a number of areas there that still lacking implementation or they have not been adequately addressed. So we want to know that the second one, if you go on your slide 19 and 20, slide 19 deals mostly about the issue of the initiation phase. And slide 20 also deals about the issue of the EMR that is still outstanding. As when are we foreseeing again coming closer to this bill to be that debate they get finalized? Thank you.
Thank you.
Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, let me start with the national framework for the innovation of actually when will the framework be developed. The framework has been developed. I want to make a distinction between the remuneration benefits and allowances. The Remuneration Commission makes recommendations to the President on termination. So the salaries all over the country are standardized from the kingship going down to the lowest level, including the headmanship. So that is standardized. It doesn't need a framework. However, the second part is the tools of trade. The tools of trade, they've been for public office bearers, the politicians as well are the same. Starting from accommodation, security, and all the things that are required to support the public office bearers in the execution of their work. So, in 20, the Remuneration Commission came up with recommendations on the tools of trade for the first time. So after that, now they also provide guidance for the provinces to say how they were supposed to deal with it. For example, they indicated that the upper limit should be 71,000 rand. You know, especially the headman. You know, 21,000, and especially in KZN, they were saying that they would, the province should actually verify the figures if they have the right number of headmen and headwomen. And after that, they also have to look at the functions, the work they do, and they also have the upper limits. They've got to determine how they will pay them. Now, the second time, I think it was 2014-15, we then had the first recommendation on the remuneration of headmen and headwomen determined. And it was determined to around 79,000. And so that all headmen and headwomen were supposed to be remunerated at that time. Eastern Cape was ahead of all provinces. It was already at 90,000 annually. So we had to negotiate with this system to not continue with the annual increase. so that, you know, we work towards equity. And also the pressure that KZN had with him and so on. KZN, you know, they came up with the figures that are, you know, they have 3,100. Initially, we were given, you know, the figure of 15,000 in the past. And because they have various in Duna, various functions and so on. But in terms of the law, the headmanship positions, the function, you know, people responsible for is called village. Those that are responsible for villages. And then it came down to 3,100. And they were not able to afford to pay all of them. They only paid about 2,900 who were participating in the traditional councils. And those that were not participating in the traditional councils were not paid. We assisted as a department, we intervened and assisted them, working with national treasury, provincial treasury, and all relevant stakeholders. And we came to the conclusion that they will not get money from anywhere. They have got to reprioritize. And they ended up reprioritizing, I suppose, to be able to pay the others that they were not paying by the same amount, which is 1,300 per toll. And they are still paying far below, you know, the amount that is determined, which is 84,000 now, or 60, which constitutes about 7,000 per month. So they are still at 1,300. And they are still negotiating with the Queen Peace in Duna to try and look at how best they can deal with us. So on the 26th, truth of trade has nothing to do with remuneration. On the 26th of May, of September 2018, we took the recommendations on the truth of trade from the Remuneration Commission, which were a bit vague. For example, they would say each king should have one official residence, without specifying the details and so on. So we got down and actually put in the details, you know, in consultation with public works and various stakeholders. And also on the area of security, we had to work with the staffs and various stakeholders to beef up those accommodations. And because they did not, you know, the president doesn't have to determine them, we took them to Minas, where all the MECs and the minister, you know, meet, and they supported that, those complex standards that we came up with. And provinces were expected to cover their own provincial, customized handbooks for that purpose. So, you know, there may be some areas where they are not complying with that, but one thing for sure, we have those nonsense standards. And if you want us to share with the committee, general chair, we can make that document available. And the issue, the example that you gave, it's a historical matter, that the resources that have been provided for the key in KZN and it's a historical matter, but what we can, you know, confirm here is that we now have those norms way forward. You know, they have to be observed. And you know, that's the issue of the framework. And then the issue of the policy, sorry,
because we will spend time on this. When you say, Gigi, the issue of okay, the end is a historical matter. No, it's not a point of order. I've asked a question and I've not. No, Chairman, please, man. Yeah. The issue I want to raise, I've not researched on that I'm raising this issue. I'm raising it because the kingdoms themselves, they are raising consistently. They are raising. And it's bigger than that. The people of the land are raising. That there is a certain kingdom here. I understand the historical context. The inequalities in the kingdoms. That we have a kingdom that has a budget to run development.
No, Chairperson, it's not that the issue was addressed at previous meetings. And maybe what you can raise is that the responsible person must
Honorable Masoud, I was feeling you struck me. I don't like this, you know, meeting. It's an open meeting for us to meet. I mean, agents must be providing plans, financial care plans. Why is doing the provided plan? I'm asking in relation to that. Please, and I want to be answered by DG, not a member of parliament.
Answered
by a member of parliament.
No, Honorable Masoud is raising a point of order. Let us hear what he said.
My other point, Chairperson, is that this information was made available, not just in one meeting, in a few previous meetings. And they understand the issue is that there was a equalization. And therefore, in the same payment, except that provinces were then given the leeway to make whatever top up as and when necessary. So I thought that maybe what we should do is just to get a comprehensive response of that, so that the issue is laid to rest, rather than keep on raising the same thing over and over again. Because, as I understand it, the way Member Bangla is responding really suggests that he doesn't understand this issue.
Thank you. I do understand this issue very much. And I'm raising it differently this issue.
No change.
No, the meeting is waiting. The DG is going to give me an answer to this. I want that answer.
I'm going
to put it simply. Maybe it's not understood by Honorable Madam. I'll put it simply. I will then put it very simply. The kings were longing of Amakos recently raised an issue. This is the parliament of the people who speak on behalf of the people. Raised an issue that a government will fail to treat our kings at an equal level. The king of Kwazulu, I'm not talking about the packages, I'm not talking about the salaries, have the budget. When are other kings in the very same fashion that we are going to standardize a situation that took also the budgets are located. King Daniel, before he was arrested, he raised the same issue. Therefore, the issue continues raising the Eastern Cape. Is there a plan? Is there going to be a national framework that is going to regulate that? That's basically the issue that I want to know when. Because you are presenting, you said, this plan is for until 2020, until yesterday. Therefore, we think that ahead will be difficult to be addressed.
Honourable Chair, let me firstly, the two examples that are given with His Majesty King's uncle, as well as King's of Guinea. Now, I want to indicate that all the other kings were appointed in 2010. They were announced on 29th of July 2010 as kings. And after Nabo Commission findings, you know, they investigated the parliamentaries, and then was that announcement. And I also know that some of them, even before that, they were sworn in as paramount chiefs and so on. However, in the KZN situation, the king there has been there for more than 40 years. And over the years, there's been that support that was provided to him and so on. I've indicated that the Remuneration Commission has now standardized that. Now, when you bring the norms and standards, at least, you know, you're not going to reduce what is there. To say, we're going to reduce what is there to bring it down. Because a norm is like a ruler, you're putting a ruler to say there mustn't be anything below this line. And we are currently working towards that effort. The Remuneration Commission, the first rule of trade, it says all the kings to have one official residence or palace. The king in place that they got about 7 or so. Why not, you know, it has been there over a long period. and then that kind of thing. So the point that we're making is there are other provinces. In Eastern Cape, for example, you would find that these local tools of trade that we came up with, they were higher than the other provinces, which are indicated with the head measure. There were 90,000 when the first upper limit was at 71,000. We negotiated with them. It is only now in 2016 that the recommendations of the commission are at 91,000 at the same level as Eastern Cape. Instead of cutting at the time when the upper limit was 71,000, we say Eastern Cape, I'm going to bring you down to 71 and so on. So this is part of our history, and we have heard it before. And this issue, we have heard that we're working towards that, you know, leveling, you know, the playing field for everybody. And I've said, even with the salaries, they are getting the same salary, and you know, all those kinds of things. What is there which is more than the others is historical. And the second question was, when is the education policy? It will be the next cabinet commission meeting. We have to do the impact assessments, and we have finalized that, we've submitted it, and we have resubmitted that, and it will be serving in the next cabinet commission. The issue of honorable sector, the areas not adequately addressed from sexual affairs, things that have not been achieved. We have slides further on where we have indicated concretely how we are going to deal with those areas that we have not achieved. And usually we do have governance structures in the departments, and I have already indicated yesterday that in the first quarter, when towards the end of the first quarter we go for the assessment of the work that has been done, and every branch is expected to report on the previous year's target that is not achieved, how far we are, so that they don't fall through the crack. So slide starting from 17, I don't have my glasses on the copy, from 17 where we have the blue things, I don't know, 15. We then indicate even the year, I mean the time, to say some of them will be completed by the end of the first quarter, the others by the end of the final quarter. That is how those things that will not have been achieved will be changed at all.
In Sukukuni, let me say far north, starting with Sukukuni, Baluben, Kalangulu, that is Tonga, Ngukunyane, that is Venda, there are four supposed in Limpopo, and still under correction. How many of these paramounts are they already receiving their budget?
The paramount is that we had in the Limpopo, if we are specific. We had two paramounts. In fact, we had one paramount initially during the research by the Kapo Commission, which was a Skokuni one. And the Kapo Commission also found that the vendors also have a kingship. There was no paramount before that in terms of the findings. And we also have the Mujaji queenship as well. Now, the Mujaji queenship has not been finalized now. The queenship is there, but the incumbent, there has been a submission which is currently being considered. So when it has been considered, then there will be an excess of budget that will follow. There's Kokuni kingship. There's a dispute that we are dealing with at the moment, which has got to be resolved as soon as possible. And then the issues of budget, you know, there is a budget that is allocated to the acting King's Kukuni. I've just engaged him 3 weeks ago as well, relating to that. And as far as King Paper is concerned, the Limpopo government is engaging those paramounts to try and assist them. However, I need to say that this deal that is before Parliament,
so traditional and Christian leadership here, will assist us to establish King's Councils. And those King's Councils will then be the budget for them to be able to function effectively and so on. At the moment, you only have royal families that are assisting in the absence of the establishment of King's Councils. We have contracted probably 60% or so of the kingships on the formula determining the number of people that have got to serve on those kingships, on those King's Councils.
Mr. Sims, GTA has covered some of the points. And this year, then we went out to together to ensure that as we visit provinces for our public hearing on the LRT, because the office now is here, you will also give some support to ensure that whatever we cover in this public hearing is captured to assist us when we finalize the bill. Since GTA General, there are no other questions, even partners in this party. I want to advise that 2 months down the line, we'll pause back in this question. Madam.
Chairperson, I thank you very much for the opportunity to comment on a matter related to traditional affairs. I'm just emboldened by what you've just mentioned, Chairperson, that you will be going around engaging a range of stakeholders. It seems to me part of the solution that is required, and I regret that I did not share this view with the DG first before I express it here. In the country, there are only two provinces that have provincial constitutions in which kings, in fact, the Christian king and the king is recognized as a constitutional monarch in that constitution. And the Eastern Cape has not done the same. I'm not even sure how they will resolve the protocol issues when you have three kings, as to how you deal with it and what role they play in the provincial legislature. The same, I suppose, with some holds for the Popo, that there isn't a provincial constitution that accords the king a particular status in addition to the recognition by the president, as to what role the king then plays. But I think that's a very important step, and hopefully in the engagement by the portfolio committee with a range of stakeholders, it would be important to ascertain what are the plans in the provincial government to work on provincial constitutions that then accord additional status, if like, to the kings that operate within the areas of jurisdiction. I think it's a very important element not to leave out. The same would then hold for the Queensland. It once it is resolved in the Western Cape, because the constitution of the Western Cape does not grant provision to any traditional leadership, because the assumption has always been that we don't have traditional leaders here. But once the Queensland bill has been assented to as an act of parliament and recognition is given to that institution, it definitely would call for a reconsideration of the status of the current constitution in the Western Cape. That's my 2 cents for it, Jefferson. Thank you.
Yeah. This is a very, very, very important area that we mustn't forget. Every time we explain the case and situation, sometimes we forget that is the provincial constitution and then allowed by the supreme law of the country to do so. And then they've made the king a constitutional monarch, not a creative king. And then how do you deal with that? It's a very important issue. I think the sooner we see some legal opinion, we may then mess it up. It was very complex. It's a very complex situation. I understand the balance issue seriously. But the more you introduce this constitutional thing, therefore, it's very difficult then to answer manner the way we would have loved to answer it, because it's different in terms of the constitution. It's a very important one that you are raising this year. We will take care of that one, and hopefully there will be someone to advise if the department is here. When we start moving, because if we start from Mpumalanga, Eastern, the second one behaves at the end. I think all the point that you are raising is going to be raised there. And then we would go to that meeting uninformed or from the position of ignorance. You know, like members of parliament must not enter any debate from the position of being ignorant, because it becomes a very difficult way of doing things. Thank you for the point, and we'll take care of it. Yes. Colleagues, can we move to court? Because what are the issues there that we think colleagues must raise? We know the budget general, we know the programs, and we know the progress that have been made, what are the challenges. But there will be other points. First, thank again the DG that you consider the proposal by the committee that we work on it, the AG proposals. And then when we're ready to realize that you really catch everything that we've raised, it's very important to not ignore proposals from the committee. If proposals are very problematic, it's always advisable for the accounting officer to come back to the committee and say, but this is not implementable. Then to simply say, this is why they don't know what they're doing, and call the necessary tension between the committee and the department. I think we've handled it very well, really. I highly appreciate that. And we hope that we are going to work in this spirit. Cooperative governance. I'm ready to raise a point. One more.
My philosophy is that, Chair, in order for something to stick, you must repeat it all the time. If my belief is that if you want something to stick, you must always repeat it. Now, this question already, yeah, it's a good one. You stick on it, it always stays. But the people in Chile, they do it like that. Now, that question will always come until there's a solution, because there are people who complain about it. Thank you for that. I think it's based on exactly what you're talking about. But that doesn't necessarily mean we can't move forward. The question I'm asking is a way forward in relation to that, because the queues are complaining. Thank you. Thank DG for the presentation yesterday. Mine is on a slide 14, the first one will be on slide 14, and you've mentioned that you want to work out a plan on the disclaimers to deal with and eliminate the municipalities and reduce the number of disclaimers. And also you mentioned in the very same slide the implementation of forensic bodies. Now, my question is, you've been monitoring all these processes, both on disclaimers and forensic bodies. What is new? What is the new mechanism that you are going to introduce? Because the last time I checked, the response has always been that municipalities, it is in the municipalities' responsibility to intervene in this respect. If municipalities are unwilling to take action in these reports, they can see to this report and do nothing about it. Why is that in the next period of years you are going to do differently in terms of dealing with this? The other one on that, I always ask, and I'm not going to stop until it happens. It was me personally who asked about a comprehensive report on forensics to the minister. And it has not come back to us. We're still in touch with the six. It's been 2 years now. I've been asking the same thing. When are we going to get that comprehensive report of actions in the 100 responses that of now have been collected? When are we going to get that? I'm even prepared that report is given to me as an individual if other members do not want me to see and view, because I'm very interested in that report. Slide 18 on institutional development. This one also I've been asking, but I'll continue to ask it because it's there in your presentation. On consequences of coaching, you spoke about intervention on anti-corruption strategy, but I'm not talking, because I know you are doing something about officials in that respect, but what are you doing? What intervention or what mechanism are we going to use to deal with politicians
who indirectly or directly mislead councils after receiving a proper legal advice from municipal managers, and because they have power to vote in councils and vote, and municipalities loses a lot of money after that. What are we going to do? And I don't know which municipality has ever made a councillor to pay on overriding decisions that were given by municipal managers not to take certain decisions. I always would like to make an example about Makana, like Dunstaff, where municipal manager advised a council differently, and Makana councillor took a different decision. And I think it's in the Infrastructure Act, the Structures Act, that decisions taken by council, which are contrary to the law, or the chairs or councillors, can be made to pay for that. And I'm not saying in Makana that happened. When are we going to see that happen in this party? We can just make it in an example. I'll be happy to make up about Makana and say, when are we going to make those councillors to Makana pay with the illegal decisions they have been taken? On the institute, I completely disagree with this thing of the institute. I raised it with Anna. In particular, under the current financial difficulties the country is confronted with. Why? I believe we invest billions of money with a local government system with the same money. To me, this looks like a duplication. Why can't we use the local government theater to then play the role of empowering the local government bodies? The special development toolkit. I want you to explain to me, we have a special framework that we have, and why do we need another toolkit? We've been having toolkits. I know South Carolina also has a lot of toolkits on the spatial memory. But why are we duplicating the web? Or what is the difference of these toolkits to the one South Carolina has been doing with those practices? I just explain to you. Basically, my questions are those. I'm going to come back when I get the answers.
How did you explain it? Yeah, it's with me. I need to commend the department in being hands-on in terms of identifying the areas that need to be strengthened. But the issue is about maybe moving faster in ensuring that indeed what you anticipate the department in assisting the people of this country generally, in ensuring that their lives are integrated. Like for instance, in this trend point that you have introduced, more especially like AD, you are to improve the human resource in ensuring that there is capacity in the personnel, in the people that are to do the work. But in other slides you've mentioned that the focus will be on the specific survey, but yeah, you have said there must be a uniform standard in terms of the lower level staff. I think that moves into a correct direction, because you find that sometimes there are managers, sometimes they are called divisional managers. They are appointed, but you find that they don't have relevant skills, more especially in the supply chain department. That's where you find that there are challenges, whereby the municipalities cannot perform in the manner that is expected, because you find that the managers are not competent and they do not have strategy to what they are doing. Another thing maybe we have spoken about, but maybe the department should also move swiftly in terms of the revenue enhancement. As last year we have seen that the Auditor General did take some money in terms of the equitable share because the municipalities are owing ESCOM. But you find that they are having a challenge in terms of collecting and also they're struggling in terms of the bill system. And sometimes you find that people are not paying because they are not correctly billed. So if maybe municipalities can be assessed in that regard, in terms of having, you know, a correct way in dealing with this issue of the link, and for them at least to have a revenue. And another thing in terms of the LED strategies, because you find sometimes that municipalities in terms of those houses, there are economic opportunities, but maybe in terms of having relevant people with relevant competence sometimes, they struggle. They cannot identify those opportunities that can assist in job creation around those communities. Maybe the government can also zoom into that space in empowering municipalities in ensuring that they come up with relevant strategies of ensuring that there is economic growth in their locality. I thank you.
Just a few comments. The first one is really a comment about the report, from the report by Mr. Mulivi on the government. And the issues, the first set of issues that are raised there that I'd like to comment on are the ones that the recommendation and the likelihood of achievements. On page 14, for instance, there's a code of good practice, and then there's a question of compliance in addition to MISA regulations and enforcement. And then there's a status of appointments under 5.1.3 on page 9. They're saying that 10 municipalities are not compliant. Now, the last column says, likely to be achieved. Just to add for a speedy resolution of these matters, pursue them with more vigor, make sure that they are sorted out. The second category is really one issue. The minister met. We are told that in relation to 38 appointments made in contravention of Systems Act, we are awaiting a letter on corrective measures to be signed by the minister. Now, one would have expected that the letter has already been crafted, signed by the minister, dispatched. I'm sure that's a very reasonable thing to say. So again, I think one can say that can be done as next. Then the question of alignment raised in relation to the matter that Honorable Paula has raised is really, in my view, failure to align. Then there's a question of a partnership, which is partly a clarity question. A partnership with the private sector. The municipalities are listed there under what is referred to as adopt a municipality initiative. But we don't have a sense of what are these projects. If you can comment on that at the time today, if not, maybe the minister should be clarified at the next meeting. The last comment is just a comment that I'm personally very encouraged by the fact that there's more and more talk of long-term plans in relation to municipalities and the integration of these two municipal IDPs. I think this will go a long way towards ensuring. work at Mutas Mandela improves for the better. Yes.
Chair, before she your friend is very strange like that all of Masonda was in page 19. Preparation for the for this technical team for election. They have last match on the 12th of June. But when you look at the election where it is likely to be achieved. But the meeting was only the last meeting was on the 12th of June. How are we thinking? How are we, can you perfect this meeting so that you can achieve? Because we don't see that there is a priority on this meeting. If it's the first, if it was last met on 12th June, now it's almost 8 months down the line. Going down to the very things like chair, I also want to raise the issue of, for this one is touched by Honorable Masola as well. The partnership. I want to understand this concept. How is it working? Partnership between the municipality and the private sector. Anyway, where this is achieved and is working well, if I can have an example of that, that's what it just says.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I will tackle some of the questions, and I will also take the liberty, if you will allow me, to then pass on some of them out to the colleagues that are with me here. The questions relating to forensic reports, disclaimers, and new mechanisms raised by Honorable Banga will be handled by Mr. Sigidi behind me. That will also then deal with the issue of the comprehensive report on forensic audits that have been done. It will also deal with the first question that Honorable Banga raised about consequences on corruption. And then Mr. Fossey on my right will deal with the partnership questions between the private sector and governments. And as far as the other issues are comments, but I will also try and deal with some of the questions relating to the questions raised by Honourable Member Tim on some aspects of human resource capacity, mental vision to LED and the like. Perhaps let me start there. Chairperson, we take the point that we need to move with speed to make sure that we tackle the issues we've already identified as requiring attention in order to address the plight of our people. On matters relating to human resource capacity as part of our plan to build resilient institutions, we have indeed focused on 756 and 757 managers. In particular, we focused on CMOs, municipal managers. We've also looked at technical directors. These are people who drive your infrastructure developments in communities. But all these people must meet certain minimum requirements that are set out in the regulations that we've passed. Indeed, areas where people have been found not to comply. We have communicated to the MECs. The MECs have in hand taken steps to make sure that the relevant municipalities do take corrective steps. There certainly would be cases that are still outstanding, but those cases will certainly receive attention. We believe we can still do so before the end of the financial year. But I'd like to also say that beyond the 755 and 756 measures, we have also gone far enough with setting up regulations that deal with lower categories of staff.
believe this is a very important area of intervention, because the bulk of your staff at municipal level are actually below Section 56 and Section 57. But we are also identifying specific areas of intervention. The area of supply chain is one of those that we consider very important. Also, increasingly, the area of local economic development is receiving increased importance. I say this advisedly because in our recent engagements with the Ministry of Small Business Development, what came clear was that local economic development doesn't seem to happen in a number of municipalities, partly because people who are responsible for those areas know very little about economic development. So what we have started doing with the Department of Small Business Development is to start engaging with them to talk about the need to professionalize local economic development, because they have a vested interest in making sure that there's someone who will support the small business sector, who understands local economic development, and who will create an environment for these entities to flourish. So there is going to be focused attention on those areas. We've already sent our letters to all municipalities across the country, requesting information from them on the qualifications of people who are responsible for local economic development, because we are keen on making sure that there is a strong interplay between the opportunities that we can leverage within the local spaces with the national economy in that sense. So that interplay is going to be important, and we've identified those areas as important going forward. The issues regarding revenue enhancement, I'm sure Mr. Skidi, who's sitting behind me, will also expand on these, but we take the point that it's going to be very important, and we have already indicated that as one of the indicators of progress we're going to make, we're going to be focusing on improving on the financial health of municipalities and strategies for revenue collection. Going to be part of that. Municipal rates, the rating of properties, is going to be part of that effort of making sure that we improve the economic health, or rather the financial health of municipalities. But we also believe that if we create an environment where small businesses are able to flourish, then we are effectively increasing the potential of people who are able to generate income and in turn be able to pay for services. So in a sense, we're identifying small business development as a very important area, local economic development as a very important area, because these can be, then become revenue streams for municipalities. From where we sit, we believe that we need to start cultivating a new consciousness amongst municipalities to enable them in the first instance to identify businesses as partners, because they need businesses as people who guarantee them a revenue stream that is constant. At the same time, businesses need municipalities that work well to make sure the services are always rendered, that there's always electricity for them to run, there's always water, that sanitation is taken care of, that the quality of the roads, you know, is maintained at all times. So the two actually need each other, perhaps more than we may have been able to identify before. So part of our overall approach is going to be this approach that I'm talking about now. Then the project that talks about transforming the space economy within municipalities actually talks more directly to issues of this kind. That said, let us redefine our relationships within the municipal spaces between the different players. It also says municipalities need to do more than just raise themselves to deliver services, but also start cultivating a kind of payment amongst members of society who are able to pay. We understand that there's a sizable number of people who are indigent, who are unable to pay, in respect of whom the National Treasury makes an allocation as part of the equitable share to make sure that free basic services are rendered to them. But for everybody else who's able to pay, we believe that we need a national discourse to start with. But that discourse would need to start at the local level to make sure that municipalities are striking a more positive relationship with the citizenry at that level. So those points, Jefferson, are noted, and they are certainly on a radar screen for the year that is upon us, effective April 1st, 2016. Perhaps let me allow Mr. Force to deal with the question that's related to his area of work, and then I will also invite Mr. Sagili to assist. Dr. Phillips is also here. There is a question that's been raised, and if clarity is sought, pronouncing I quite have it, on there's a point that relates to MISA which has been raised. But I'll come to perhaps, let me allow Mr. Fussi to deal with the questions that relate to his area, and then I'll come back to that sentence.
Thanks, DJ. Thank you, Chair, and other members. The issue of partnerships, Chair, in particular, the program on the international doctor mortality. This is a program that was initiated when the department was implementing the local government alarm strategy. Basically, we encouraged the private sector to come on board in providing support to mortality. There are quite a number of private sector companies that have come forward. I mean, just a few examples, Santam and Tanla, they supported the Mafeking local mortality with the disaster management on that area through providing equipment, through training those units in that mortality that are responsible for management of fire, but also responsive units to various disasters in that area. So building the whole capability of the mortality around disaster. All mutual, they are supporting about 5 municipalities, and it ranges from financial management in terms of providing training, but in certain areas, attending officials, experts to advise the municipality specifically on HR issues. So they will cover those message plans. They are also working with the Buffalo system around the administrative areas, including the whole management, specific areas, whether it's financial management or HR policy. So there are quite a number of the companies and the specific areas that they are providing support. We continue to work with them. And then, of course, in the certain areas, there will be challenges, but the department, we work closely with these companies. Recently, we have also received more offers from other companies who want to get involved in the municipality. So, there was an issue that was raised also on special, the toolkit. I think the issue of the special toolkit would be linked also to the question or comment around long-term planning for municipalities. But the approach as a department, we're not responsible, for example, for Sloma. But in the context of planning, we encourage municipalities when they look at issues of planning, they're able to have a holistic approach and then a long-term approach in how they plan. Even issues of LED, how they use the levers that the municipality has, whether it's in terms of infrastructure funding, how they implement that infrastructure in the broader context of economic development, but also how they use their special innovation initiatives to respond to this. So there will be a number of initiatives, whether from the Department of Rural Development around global implementation. But in the context of the development, we will also continue to issue toolkits and other sort of guidelines to assist municipalities with training. Just to described by the honorable member, many of these municipalities have a lot of potential in terms of the resources. If you take a district like Waterberg, Danana, but it's how those municipalities are planning, how they are collaborating with the other local municipalities to take advantage of those opportunities. And it's all dependent on how municipalities plan, the leadership that is provided, and the skill that municipalities have in terms of being able to have sort of a forward-looking approach and using them, as I was saying, the levers that it is in the municipalities in terms of whether it's funding for planning, for infrastructure, and then other areas. So, I think those were the two elements.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson. Honourable Member Masono made reference to site number 19, right? If I recall. And my reading of what is on slide number 19 doesn't say letters are awaiting the Minister's signature. What it says, letters were written to MECs. So I hope that this clarifies the matter, that in fact letters were written. If you look at the, on slide number 19, the first target, which is 5.9.4, in the third column of cumulative progress, that's where we indicate that in fact letters were written to the MECs by the Minister, not that the letters are awaiting signature. Right. But let me hand over to Mr. Sikini to deal with the other questions.
In such that, Chair, I do not want to correct Honorable Masof because I'm not the DG.
Thanks for allowing me to correct the Honorable Member.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think the question by Honorable Banga, I'll take it as a follow-up question to the input that we gave during the BRR report, because it indicates what are the new mechanisms that we have to deal with issues that emanate from forex reports. Last time I indicated that the forensic report has been presented to council and council has to take particular decisions around it. Now what we have observed is that some of the reports that are presented to council, the resolution will be, the report is noted. But since we had decided that all forensic reports that are in municipalities should be submitted to the National Department for Assessment. You remember when I reported then that we had 115 reports that we had received, and we had around 106 that we had done the assessment and found that indeed there were matters that could be referred to law enforcement agencies. So what we have is we have a partnership with the law enforcement agencies. We have just indicated to them that we want a unit that will focus specifically on local government issues, which they have agreed. And currently, since the last BRR report, we had two more reports, forensic reports that we have assessed, and 18 have been referred to the assets for special units. And 10 have been referred to the SIU, and they are those that are with the DPCI. When I checked with the DPCI as to, I just gave them specific questions that I wanted them to indicate how many have been dealt with. 2 weeks ago, they indicated that the report is still coming. So to answer the question directly, the new mechanisms that we are applying is, we are assessing the reports at the National Department with the law enforcement agencies, and those that require a particular law enforcement agent is referred to that agent, and then they deal with it in that way, irrespective of the processes that are in the municipality. The second issue was, when are we going to give you the comprehensive report on all the forensics and those that we have assessed? The end of the financial year, we'll be providing that report, we'll present the report to mechanism to deal with matters that might, that can tell us for politicians at the local government level might have done in contravention or in contravention of perhaps the advice that the accounting officer might have given. Besides the things that we have already mentioned, the issues around the code of conduct for councillors, we have only one lever that we have, especially if the matter is relating to financial matters. And that lever only comes once after 5 years. The lever that we have currently, which we seek to implement, is the lever around the gratuity for non-returning councillors. So it would only cover those that would be non-returning. What we'll do is that we have started communicating with some of these municipalities. If a councillor is owing some money to the municipality, either due to incorrect grading, we'll have to recover that money by not paying that particular councillor the gratuity for non-returning councillors. You'll remember, Honorable Banga, that in 2011, this lever, we used it for those who were owing SARS, and we said, if you are owing SARS, we'll first check with SARS. If you're owing SARS, we'll pay directly to SARS. But at the moment, we'll appreciate if there are other initiatives that the committee members might advise us on how we can deal with this matter, because most of the time, because of the nature of a council, if the council is not doing it the way they have to deal with it, it becomes very impossible for us to deal with it. But even the matter relating to the matters that we've referred to earlier, which are forensic reports, then we can refer them to law enforcement agencies. The last one that you raised was the issue around the institute. In fact, it was the comments, which we agree with you. If you look at the slide, we have indicated that we have realized that there is this kind of duplication. And we know that DPSA has come up with the PEM Act, which also talks about certain matters relating to issues of training. So we are engaging with SALGA, we are engaging with the FITA, we have a member of the staff who is sitting in the FITA board, because we don't want a duplication of the initiative beside the initiative at that time. And we are negotiating with SALGA to come up with a common program on the councillor election program immediately when the new councillors are elected. But that is going to be a sort of a short-term one. On the long-term side, we are saying, let's engage with the School of Government as well as the FITA to look at what are the long-term councillor training needs that will be required, so that when you train a councillor, immediately when the term of that councillor ends, this councillor can be utilized for other purposes. I think, Honorable Chair, the other comments that were made by Honorable Tembu have been covered by the DG. And just on the issue that Honorable Mokoto
is a problem, colleagues, we are not here for the last time, yes. There's a caucus here too. They will need to clean first for the caucus to sit too. It's a special caucus of the current party. I think they will start squatting at the door already to come in. I want to make a proposal that we will continue in the next meeting, really, if there are still some questions that are standing. But I think many questions have been answered. The agenda, the program is there. The CSV will not sit on that. Yeah.
Sorry, sir, my point is this. We're going into budget dates and DORA and things like that, and a lot of these issues need to be resolved while we've got the people here. My question is, are we going to do that at the next committee meeting, in other words, next week Tuesday, or are we going to push it out?
No. We won't push it out. I thought it would be only your question. Our members have a lot of questions.
Now, we'll see, then we'll look at the calendar. There will be other meetings that may change because of the squeezing. The program of parliament can be very difficult to accommodate each and every day. But I think they are available every time. But also, you're a good writer. It won't be harmful if you present questions in writing. And they will come in and say, these are answers to the question. And we give it an item on our agenda. It's just a matter now that they have to come in and clean here. The caucus of 249, the big caucus, already outside. I think my proposal, if it's accepted by the meeting on our matter, is to adjourn the meeting. Next week, of course, the meeting will be in touch with the Director General and other colleagues. That are available, then we can continue some of the questions that are still. Director General.
Chairperson, thank you very much. We will certainly endeavor to make ourselves available when we are needed. I just wanted to give parting shots to Honourable Member Mteta. And after the meeting of June, we actually had two other meetings to deal with this, but the transition of the setting up of new municipalities is the responsibility of MECs, and there are provincial teams that are looking at the transition, and they are meeting on a regular basis. We also have others at the district level to focus on locals that are being amalgamated within the areas of jurisdiction. So there are a litany of meetings already taking place.